Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, February 13, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you are listening live over another network and would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 712-770-4160. Our participant code is 385698. If anyone would like to ask a question by email, you can email your questions to questions, it's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find some of their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Okay, we're going to start off, as we usually do, with a reading of a scripture. Tonight's scripture is going to be Galatians chapter 5, verses 16 through 26, walking in the Spirit. Galatians 5, verses 16 through 26. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary, the one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. But if ye be led of the Spirit, ye are not under the law. Not the works of the flesh are works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envying, murderers, drunkenness, reveling, and such like, of which I tell you before, as I have also told you in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruits of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. And they that are Christ's have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not be desirous of vainglory, provoking one another to envying one another. Okay, that was Galatians chapter 5, verses 16 through 26, walking in the Spirit. Okay, I first want to start off with an announcement and a reminder. We have sent out an email, I think, over the weekend concerning the event coming up here in New York with Lavoie Finnegan's daughter. She's going to be visiting New York this coming Friday. She'll be at 6 o'clock. And that'll be at the Lamala Civic Center. Lamala Civic Center. Do we have this information up on our website, Jan? We did send email out.
It's out in the weekly newsletter. Okay. I don't believe it's on the website.
All right. Well, maybe someone could drop it in one of the conversation. I think the front page, people can throw some information out. But in any event, it's 108 Lamala, L-O-M-A-L-A, Lane in Hopewell Junction, New York. Now, that's at 6 p.m. I don't know how long the event is going to go. I suppose an hour and a half or so, maybe. I don't know. But since people are going to be visiting from different states, we have people coming in from maybe from the New England area, other parts of New York. We have people coming in from Pennsylvania. And so what we decided to do on Friday to meet earlier at 1 p.m. So we're going to be meeting in Perkins. That's a diner at 1 p.m. And that also, I believe, is, goodness, Wappingers. It's on Route 9. Let me see if I can give you some information on that. Okay, that is going to be, it's, I got 1576 Route 9, Wappingers Falls. I think we actually have two addresses on that, Jan. I found this other one, which is Route 9 address. What address do you have? That might be the side road address.
Well, I've got the 1576 Sergeant Palmateer Way, number 11, in Wappingers Falls. That's right off Route 9.
Well, right, that is Route 9. Staple. That is Route 9. So it's 1576 Route 9 or Wappingers Falls. And we did put a phone number in here if anybody wanted to call to get directions or they got lost. It's an 845 number. 296-1575. That's 845-296-1575. We'll be meeting there at about 1 p.m. We'll start collecting at about 1 p.m. We'll spend the afternoon there, have conversation until about 5. So we'll meet for, a lunch and then maybe something small before we head over to the other place. Well, the other place, is that serving food, do we know, Jen?
No, I don't believe it does.
Okay, so it's just the event. So, so we're going to be getting together from 1 till about 5. That's about 4 hours there. And then at 5 o'clock, we'll head over to the other place. That event starts at 6. And however long that's going to go, I don't know. So that is this Friday, the 17th. And if anybody can't find the information, you can play this record back. Just go up onto the call here and click on... today's call. We usually post it at the end of the night or the first thing in the morning. But click on today's call and you'll hear this information again. Or worse comes to worse, you can bother Jan. Give him a call. Find him under the directories. His phone number under the directory, or drop him an email, jan@nationallibertyalliance.org. But anyway, everyone should have that. Look for the newsletter that is sent out. Okay, so. Again, that's Lavoy Finnegan's daughter, One Cowboy's Daughter Standing for Freedom event, February 17th at 6 p.m. Okay, let me get back to where we started here. Okay, a couple of things. We've been hearing some talk, and I've been asking others about it. We really haven't got much information. I had a little time, so I researched it myself. It didn't take long to really research this out. About an oath of office. There's a word out there that there is a court case, and I've heard it from a couple of different perspectives, that is a court case has been settled on and ruled, and I was presumptuous that it was the United States Supreme Court, and that the judge ruled that the case was, that the cases that every judge since 1991, I think it was, has not been taken a proper oath, and therefore every case that they ruled upon is null and void. That is not true. Then I heard another story that the case has been filed. The case has been decided from by the federal level, not necessarily on the United States level, but on the lower level, the federal district levels. To my knowledge, that's not true at all either. But I did find the information, and it does say that the case was a filed case in the federal courts. It doesn't give the who versus who in it. It doesn't give us a case number or any identification to it. But I did get the details, and I did get the argument that is being made. So I read through that article, and I'm going to give you what I gleaned out of it, just so that we all know. The United States Constitution, Article 4, Clause 3, says that the senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislators and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. Okay. Now, Congress did write a code concerning this, and it's U.S. 28, subsection 453, and it's oath of justices and judges, and this is how it reads there in the code. Each justice or judge of the United States shall take the following oath or affirmation before performing the duties of his office. I, so-and-so, do solemnly swear or affirm that I will administer justice without respect to persons and do equal right to the poor and to the rich, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform all the duties incumbent upon me as judge justice under the Constitution and the laws of the United States, so help me God. Okay, and that was originally set out there in 1948, and it was updated, and we've got the updated what we read in 1990. Now, the position that this individual has taken is really summed up in one paragraph. Although it was a few pages of information, it's really summed up in one paragraph. And it says here, the only duties incumbent upon justices, this is the opinion of the individual writing the paper, okay, who's bringing it into the courts, which I believe it's in the courts, but it hasn't gone anywhere yet. There's no ruling on it, to my knowledge, and so I just don't know where it's going, but this is the guts of the paper. The only duties incumbent upon justices and judges of the United States to discharge or performed are provided in statutes of Congress, i.e., the laws of the United States. The Constitution provides none, because there is no provision of the Constitution that requires a justice or a judge of the United States to discharge or perform any duties. There are no duties under the Constitution incumbent upon any such justice to judge, to discharge, or perform. Meaning mentioned of the Constitution is the 1990 Amendment, Oath of 28 U.S.C., which we had read, is superfluous and may be omitted from said oath without changing its meaning. So the idea from this person is that it's an oath that they don't really take about the Constitution. Now, I do agree this is a very weak oath, and I do agree it doesn't say that it's to support this Constitution. It is clear in the Constitution they need to be saying those words, that they're bound by oath and affirmation to support the Constitution of the United States of America. And it is not there. So that is a faulty situation. There are two other things here. It does refer to the laws of the United States, and it refers in this oath, okay, each justice or judge of the United States shall take the following oath affirming before performing the duties of his office, I, so on and so forth, to solemnly swear affirm that I will administer justice without respect to persons, do right to and do equal right to the poor and to the rich, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform all duties incumbent upon me as judge or justice under the Constitution and laws of the United States. So they're agreeing to keep the laws of the United States, and of course any law that's repugnant is null and void, and it has to be constitutional. But the claim here, the point here is that it's under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. Now this person is claiming two things. Because there is no provisions of the Constitution that requires a justice or judge of the United States to discharge or perform the duties, there are no duties under the Constitution incumbent upon any such justice or judge to discharge or perform. That's not true, and I'll tell you why. Because they are saying that they're going to obey the laws under the Constitution and the laws of the laws of the United States, which is created under the Constitution. Let me reread a little earlier on in that guy's paragraph. The only duties incumbent upon a justice or justice of the United States to discharge or perform are provided in the statutes of Congress. And the statutes in Congress, right there, they have to apply those statutes. And anything that's not repugnant to the Constitution must be applied as law. It's a statute written by Congress, and it is defined a little different as it would be as law, where it'd be written by we, the people, because only the people can make law. Well, of course, God makes law. He makes the eternal law. But our law that we make is the law for our governments to provide their jurisdictions and, what they can do and what they can't do. And that's the law of the land. That's our law. That's what we speak the law, they obey it, and that's it. That's the way it works.
Hey, John.
We've given them some authority to write some law. Okay. Hang on 1 second, John. I just want to make this final point. Almost there. And here is the final point that makes this incorrect, his position incorrect. I mean, it's nice that he caught some of this stuff, but he has an error here. And it's in Article 6, Clause 2, which is a well-known clause. It's the Supremacy Clause. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made pursuant thereof, and all treaties made of which shall be made under the authorities of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any other state contrary to the contrary, notwithstanding. Okay, so right there. Right there, under this weak, it is a weak, oath, I agree, and it needs to be fortified. Congress needs to correct this, but it's still, they're still bound by taking an oath, and their oath, again, is that they will discharge and perform the duties incumbent upon them as justices or justice under the Constitution. Whereas this individual says there is no provisions of the Constitution that require justice or justice to discharge or perform any duties. There are no duties under the Constitution incumbent upon any such justice or just judges. Article 4, Clause 2 is clear. It is a duty that they are bound upon to obey and hold. Now, with that said, if these judges, for some reason, and believe me, they're self-deluded, you know, Satan is self-deluded, and anybody working evil is self-deluded. That's why they do evil. If they understood the consequences, they wouldn't be doing it. But in any event, these people, if they think that they're going to get there's some kind of magic connection here, these words in some way, that there's some, you know, double mumbo-jumbo talk, and they're able to exercise their way out, they're wrong. It doesn't work logically. They're still bound by it. They're going to be held accountable before it. And if they think they're going to get away with having to not pay the crime because they got some kind of tricky words, it doesn't work. It's not here. It's not going to be found. So I don't know what it is that they think that they're hiding behind. Or maybe they figure that they got so much control that they'll never be brought to justice and they have nothing to worry about. Well, I think they're about to be brought to be shown that they're wrong between what we're doing here as the people and with what President Trump is doing and many others. The pressures of the people are upon them. They don't know whether they're coming or going. They can't even get a wind. This president has been beating them up left and right every single day, ripping down their structure. Anybody who's paying attention to what's going on, he's ripping down their structure. I can't believe how fast this guy is moving. And the enemy can't even get a breath. Can't even get a breath. You know, go out to nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight news, and we put about three or four new pages up here. One is the White House briefings. Okay, there's four or five briefings a week. Really, really very informative. Anybody's not watching them should watch them every day. Okay? There's the President Weekly Address. That's once a week. We only got one up there. He's due this week for a second one. And then there's Trump in the news. We've got lots of news on Trump's meetings and talking with people and things he's doing. I mean, he's just destroying these people. He's bringing back business into the nation. He's bringing large corporations and countries. People are starting to feel better and so on. And then we have the lawless government, which we've been finding a lot of stuff up there in Congress, which is really revealing a lot of stuff. And I'm kind of surprised. There's some people up there really doing some good work. And we need to be informed of that. So those first four news programs up there, White House briefing, Presidential Weekly Address, Trump in the News, and Lawless Government, those four pages, it's already up on the top of the news. I suggest everyone should be looking at these pages every day and be informed on what's going on. We also have other news, and we're going to have a blog station up here shortly, and we're also going to have a news station that National Liberty Alliance will be doing. It'll be the I'm not sure exactly how we'll phrase it, but it will be NLA News, and it'll work. Everything will work around the workings of the courts and the grand juries and what we're doing and what's going on in the three branches of government, particularly on the federal level. But other things in the news too that are important, and the habeas corpus that we're trying to enforce, and so on and so forth. So, Gerard, you wanted to pipe in now?
Yeah. What I was going to say is the reason that he's saying that they don't have an oath is when he asked them by what authority they were taking his territorial property, they went silent. He wanted their oath and their bond and by what authority. And this also has to do with the territorial property that they've taken jurisdiction illegally over. So this is a very specific, and people are taking this thing out of context and trying to apply it to all cases. This is very specific to his case. Although it might help the farmers out there, you know what I mean? But what he's saying is, you know, they didn't have the authority to materially alter that oath, and that they have limited jurisdiction under the law, and that when they took jurisdiction and tried to make a ruling, that they had no jurisdiction to do it because it was a federal territory or something to that effect. But this is deeper than just, it's not, people are misapplying this to everything, and that's not the case, you know.
Okay. All right, so, you know, Rita, beware, because people run with these things quite quickly, and next thing you know, they're being piped in as truth. I also had a meeting with another individual concerning, we had spoken about this over the past week or two, and I think it was 2 weeks ago when we first started talking about this a little bit, and someone wanted to put some information in, one of our members, of a website, which I thought, well, maybe we shouldn't do it until we look to see what's going on the website and see what we think about it. And also the position had to do with the 1787 Constitution. Now, I don't know how many people have heard about the 1787 Constitution. I'm sure a lot of people have because it's all over the Internet. When I first started getting involved in this, I heard about the 1787 Constitution. But I've never seen it. I've never read it. I could never find it anywhere. And many people who have brought this up, you know, I challenge them, oh, it's there, you got it. But then they never get back with it. You know, I've learned over time that, you know, I take everything with a grain of salt, but I'm not going to run with anything as truth until I surely know it's true. Now, if I get it from a good source, I might say that this is likely true, you know, and I'll make the mention I haven't checked it out myself yet. But look, we have to check everything out. We can't take anything for granted at all, you know. But in any event, this individual, we spent quite a bit of time talking back and forth, and they did send me some information, a copy of the 1787 Constitution, and also some fictional lore, which we're already aware of, most of it, if not all of it, and I understand how they're making the case on that. You know, because something is written down by Congress as if it's law, it's no law at all if it's repugnant to the Constitution. Take U.S. Code 26 itself. U.S. Code 26 is probably the largest code written out there. I mean, it's 10,000 pages and more, okay? When I first found it, it was almost 10,000. It was 7,900 pages or something, you know? And I got an electronic form. And I was really searching through it electronically. I was able to do Royd searches and to discover the game they're playing. You know, the computers have really opened up our ability to really do some research on phrases and words to discover, you know, what's the meaning of this and what's the meaning of that. But in any event, U.S. Code 26, if you go through it very carefully, and we do have this recorded up on our page somewhere, so I forget where, but I do have this information in my notes that I use from time to time, especially if it's an IRS case. It says clearly U.S. 26 is not law. It's not intended to be law, okay? But it's buried in 10,000 pages. Try to bring that up in the courtroom. You'll be silenced, of course. But, of course, there are ways to go around to do things. You have to be in control of that court. You have to be in control by day one if you're going to win in an IRS case. But in any event, it's similar anywhere else. All these laws are not laws. These are all built up. It really stems off of the Organic Act of 1871, I think it is, and that's when all of this stuff really starts to come to play, and they start to put all their ugly word magic inside of our legislation, a little bit here and a little bit there, and they're constructing something. You know, when you put it all together, you know, it's hidden very well, but when they have a way to look at it, and all of a sudden, voila, there it is. Study the rules, the federal rules of federal procedure, and you'll discover it's repugnant. It's disgusting. Yeah, they got some good ideas and they're good rules and they got some good forms that they can use and so on and so forth. Of course, they try to control the words. I change them. But nevertheless, It's sewed from beginning to end. Hidden in there is the in-rem process. And once you start getting into that part of the process, which I think it's called Part B, I think they got part the numbers and then Part A and Part B or something like that, if I recall. But in any event, you go through that, and there's so much in-rem process, and then they start referring to the things up in the first part, which is supposed to be the law of the land. The other thing is under admiralty law, law of the sea. And all of a sudden, they're bringing it right back up. And it's really disgusting what they have done with this. And they've really sewed it through. That's why the IRS comes out in rem against you. Federal government, federal courts, always when they're coming into federal courts, these attorneys that understand how the process work, usually the U.S. attorneys, they're always using in rem processes. And you don't even know it, okay, because it's all hidden in the language. And they even put it in there that you got 15 days to reject it. Otherwise, it's too late to reject. Now, go figure that one out. That in itself is null and void. And again, when you hide something like that, that's called fraud. There's so many things against it. We compete it on so many levels. They can play with their magic words, and they can, you know, click their heels and bring us all to their hell. It's not going to work that way. As long as we, the people, wake up and do something about it and take it back into the courts, and let's put these people in jail. Because that's what we have our jails for, is to fill them up with these people. But anyway, problems that we have to be aware of in the federal court, problems with this 1787 Constitution. So anyway, this person sent me this information. I went through it. I understood. I already was very much aware of all of the codes, if not most of them anyway. But then I got down to the Constitution that he had sent. And I went through it with a fine-tooth comb to some degree. I mean, maybe it's best if someone reads it alongside with another Constitution to see for sure. But I spent a good 20 minutes with that Constitution, and I'm very familiar with the Constitution. And I went through it, you know, side by side, going down, looking at it, and it was the exact same thing, nothing different than the 1789. So again, I'm back to square one. I do not have a copy yet of the 1789. Now, maybe this individual made a mistake and sent me the wrong one, and we'll try to find that out, and we'll try to get the other one. But still, to this day, I personally have never seen the 1787 Constitution. That is supposed to be the Constitution. The problem with that Constitution, to be the real Constitution, the real problem with that one, is that the consideration, if there is one, it would be an earlier draft, and it was refused to be signed by many states because there was some things in there that they didn't like, and the genius of the Bill of Rights came in play. I don't know that they changed many words, if any, under the original, you know, when they had the original draft waiting for the Bill of Rights. But we do know that they did sign that Constitution with the agreement that the Bill of Rights would become part of the Constitution, part and parcel, not just an amendment, even though it's called amendments, the first 10 amendments. No, it is part and parcel, okay, of that Constitution. The Constitution is to be read in light of the Bill of Rights. And if anything in that Constitution is repugnant to that Bill of Rights, then it is null and void. And therefore, it teaches us how to interpret the Constitution. We can interpret the Constitution in light of the Bill of Rights. And that's key. You know, I don't know how many people really understand the power of what I'm talking about here. You know, I'm a Bible student over 30, 35 years, and I learned very, very early on to read the Bible in light of the Bible. Not in light of any other book or any other thing. And only then can you really start to appreciate the deep spiritual things in the Bible, because it becomes its own interpreter. And it becomes, you know, if there's a contradiction between two points, well, then there's a fine-tuning going on. You've got to find a way to bring it into harmony. I have never found a contradiction in the Bible that I have not been able to find harmony. It appears on the surface that there's a conflict, but really when you're digging down and you're looking into the spiritual side of things and you're working things out, it's very harmonious. And sometimes the contradiction is because sometimes words have more than one meaning. And you'll find a Greek word or a Hebrew word And when you dig deep in, God may use it in two or three different ways. So you kind of see it from different vantage points. And all of that has to be appreciated. Same thing with the Constitution. And the Constitution is a far, far more simple book to read. After all, it's very small. And to be able to comprehend a lot easier than the Bible. And so if you read that Constitution in light of the Bill of Rights, again, it's the Bill of Prohibition. You can't do this, you can't do that, and you can't do the other thing. If you're going to violate me here, you can't do that. If you're going to violate me here, you can't do that. That's how we have to look at that Constitution. But anyway, the word is out, I'm putting it out now, that the guy, I don't want to bring up his name, but the individual who sent me this information, maybe you can take a look to see if you sent me the wrong information, because they're identical. Jan, you went through it also, didn't you?
I did the same comparison. I didn't go through the whole thing. I just started going Article 1 and 2 and so on, and it seemed to read exactly the same.
Yeah, so maybe he made a mistake. So we're still looking for the missing 1787 Constitution, and I would like to say I have been looking for that for at least 8 or 9 years now. Yet to find it. Found many people telling me about it. Not one of them ever produced it. So maybe this individual can do it. Okay, that's all I got on that. So two things that we've put to bed, at least at this point. Don't believe everything you read on websites. That's where we fall into trouble. Okay? Let's check things out. Look for more than one source. You know what? Here's the key. If someone's going to tell you something about the law and they never actually ever get to the law, something's wrong, okay? If someone's going to tell you about the news, but they never actually get to the news, something's wrong. I just want the news. I want the facts. Tell me what they said. Just turn the audio on. Let me hear, and I'll decide for myself how I perceive and understand the words coming out of that person's mouth. It's that simple. It doesn't get any more difficult than that. I cannot tell you how many times I've read on websites this, that, and the other thing, and they quote little pieces maybe from time to time, or they make a reference to it. They're big on making references, but never putting the words there. I go look them up, and hey, wait a second here. This didn't say that, and that didn't say this. And I read it, I see it from a whole new light. They totally misunderstood. Hey, sometimes I might misunderstand, too. We all have error in us. But, you know, at least here at National Liberty Alliance, when we misunderstand, at some point when someone brings correction to us, because we will be diligent in considering correction in every case, then we will make that correction. And we have many times over the years we've been working here in NLA to develop this process for the administration for the grand jury. Okay, let me see what else we have. Are there any questions out there, Jan? Or any announcements?
I did not receive any questions, but I do have some additional information on the Finnegan One Cowboy's Daughter Standing for Freedom events. First, I'd like to add that Lavoie's widow, Jeanette, has been traveling to some of these events, and the one in New York State on Friday that you mentioned at 6 p.m. at the Loma Law Civic Center, I have been told that Jeanette will be there as well as Shelley, so that would be really great if you'd be able to meet and greet both of them. Also, there are two other events this week. The first is in my home state, Pennsylvania. It's Wednesday the 15th. It's down in the Philly area. So if you live in even Delaware, Maryland, or Jersey, it's not that far a drive over to King of Prussia, which is where it's the venue for that event. It's at 170 Allendale Road, King of Prussia, PA. And that is, I believe, a volunteer fire department that has a banquet room and that sort of thing. The street address was mislabeled in the newsletter. It said 17170. It's actually just 170. It's right near the interstate, easy to get to. It's like you get off the cloverleaf and there's the fire hall. So I would encourage everybody that's within driving distance of that to go to the one in Pennsylvania. And then the next day, or Saturday after the one in New York State, they're up in Massachusetts. They have, that's Saturday the 18th. 6 p.m., they're having a meeting at the AmVets Post number 147 in Haverhill, Mass., and that's right up along the New Hampshire border. Short drive, so if you live in New Hampshire or Massachusetts, I would encourage you to drop in there as well. Now, I don't know if Jeanette will be at those other two events. I couldn't find out, but hopefully she will, and be a plus if she's there also. So please try and go out and get to meet and know these people, meet and greet them, say hi, tell them you're from NLA, and we're supporting you. And that's about all the announcements that I have for tonight.
Okay. Does Robert have anything to report, or anybody else have anything to report that you're aware of?
Yeah, Robert has some more information on the Western Patriots, and Ollie has a little something he'd like to add as well. So I guess Robert's next on the list.
Okay, Robert, you can unmute yourself,
evening.
I'm sure. Good.
Yeah.
I, a little bit on that the 1787 Constitution. I've never seen it, but here recently, I just seen a brief something on it. And what I believe is 1787 is when they began writing what ultimately became the 1789, because, you know, they can't put it together overnight.
Yeah, that's
and
what
they,
I thought.
They had to make some changes because of the Bill of Rights being demanded that it be put in, or some of the states would not sign it. And, you know, they just can't fax it back and forth. And so it took some time. And so that is the belief that I formed, is that they started writing it in 1787, and it wasn't finished until 1789.
Yeah, that was the very same conclusion I had, too, that if there one exists, it's probably the earlier draft. And remember, the 1789 would not have included the anti-federalist conversations and arguments, which actually came through being the development, ultimately, I believe, of the Bill of Rights from the standpoint that they found whatever flaws. And again, when you put the rights of people in there and say, don't break these rights, no matter what we've given them before, anything way they interpret that would hurt our unalienable rights is null and void. You can't do it. So my conclusion was the same as yours.
Well, on the court cases now, they are into the opening arguments in Nevada. And, of course, Cliven's trial is not until the second one. You know, they're having three trials in Nevada. Cliven will be in the second trial. Of course, the supporters, we have supporters there in Nevada, too, and they start the day out with prayer. And then they go in the courthouse. And I don't have all the information. However, Judge Navarro has ordered the prosecutors to turn over all the information concerning the BLM. You know, the prosecutors were trying to protect the BLM and not turn over the information they had. Well, because the special agent in charge at Bunkerville and at in Oregon at the Malheur County, special agent Daniel Love, and he had to go. You know, they just investigated him and found that he was threatening other agents and different police departments and stuff to keep quiet about what he was doing, trying to protect himself. And so my understanding, he's no longer with the BLM. However, he is the key witness for the prosecution. And so the judge has ordered the prosecutors to turn over all the information on the wrongdoings of the government and the BLM and all. So that's the good news. That could delay the trial, I would suppose, because
you know, it's beginning to sound there, Robert, like this judge is not willing to go along with the conspiracy. That's what it's beginning to sound. Are you getting that impression?
Well, I think, you know, she was in the beginning, but I think she's getting a little concerned about, you know, the events, you know, after the election. I think maybe she's seeing that she's got to protect herself a little bit with Trump in office and the talk going, and you know, I think she's gotten scared.
Maybe she's seeing justice heading away, and they don't like justice. So.
Yeah.
But again.
But in Oregon, tomorrow begins the trial in Portland. So it's it'll be jury. Probably take 2, maybe 3 days to pick a jury, but it starts tomorrow. And so nothing really happening yet. I am kind of getting a little word here and there about how they're trying to stack the Judge Anna Brown is trying to stack the jury again in favor of the feds by, you know, I guess by who they've been notifying. Some of the word has gotten out. And so the supporters are all gearing up, ready to get into it again with the constitutional handbooks and the jury nullification books. But they're also asking for more people to be there. The more, the better. And so anybody that's around Pahrump, Nevada, and around Portland, Oregon, that can make it to the court, whether you go inside or not, you know, come and wave flags and help hand out Constitution books and talk about jury nullification. There'll be other supporters out there waving flags and talking and blowing the shofar horn. You know, we marched around the walls of Jericho the last trial and blowing that shofar horn, and the walls fell. And they're at it again this year in both states. Some of the supporters are traveling back and forth. So that's where everything is standing now. You know, even Anna Brown, though, up here in Portland, she's been getting on the prosecutor's case about things too, because of, you know, their things that they're doing is putting her in a bad light, worse than what she's already in.
Well, maybe she should stop breaking the law, you know.
Yeah, that would help,
Yeah.
Okay. But that's where we
Anything
stand
else,
right
Robert?
Now. No,
okay.
That's where we stand.
I appreciate the update. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. Anybody else out there, Jan, that's got any kind of an update or anything that we need to hear?
Yes. Ollie, if we can find him here.
Ollie. While we're looking for Ollie, you know, we're really trying to push and activate all of our committees. We had a meeting this evening before tonight's program, and we're really trying to get people up and going and moving. We've got a lot of committees. We've got the Investigative and Research Committee. We need help to put together, and also the Law Advisory Committee. Those two committees are working together to bringing whatever law to the cases that we're looking into that they can bring, and also help gather evidence and information, documentation for these court cases. We've got the Robinson case. We've got the Wildlife Preserve case. We've got, yep.
They may want to look into Daniel Love and see if they can dig up any information that maybe the defense attorneys can use.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you have any kind of just basic information on that, Robert, with his name on it, we'll dig deeper. We also want to find out who with the Obama administration was sent down there, which really was the push that had LaVoy Finnegan killed, because as soon as that individual showed up, that LaVoy said the day after that things have changed. The whole tone has changed. It no longer is a friendly attitude. Now it's all rifles and, you know, weaponry up front, full military gear, seriousness, and so on and so forth. It's a whole, he talked about, you can hear the saber rattling. They were rattling the saber.
Well, that was,
and 2 days later, he died.
Yeah, well, that was Bretzling that came in. I think Daniel Bretzling? Love was already there.
Bretzling, is that the one from the administration? Do you know what his position was?
That was one that was, well, he was the special agent in charge of Oregon.
Right, but what they did, I remember very specifically, and I saw this in a video, and where the Obama administration was sending this one individual down to deal with the problem because they got the letter from the governor. Was it Governor Brown? I think her name is Brown, too.
Right.
And got that letter from her, which the whole thing was a setup. They write this letter, ask for us to come in, and we'll come in. And so they wrote, wrote the letter, and then they came in, and they sent a representative. And when that guy hit the ground 3 days later, Lavoy Finnegan was dead. And everything changed. The whole attitude changed.
Both of them special agents had been in trouble before.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to put the pressure on Trump at some point in time. We're going to give him a little more leeway here on this because he's got a lot of work to do. And look, he's made nice with law enforcement on the federal level, at every federal level. He's made nice with the sheriffs across America and all police forces across America.
Right.
And so he's setting the stage up. But I think as time goes on, he's going to start reaching down to grab these people that are really doing damage to we the people, killing us and imprisoning us and abusing us and so on. So,
a lot of the supporters are getting very anxious. They've got a campaign going, sending all kinds of information and videos and stuff to President Trump right now.
Mm. Yeah.
I've been trying to, you know, explain to them how, you know, Trump doesn't have all the power in the world to do just anything he wants, and that in order to do something for the Patriots, he had to get his AG confirmed, and that took a while. And they've got things that's very important. It's got to be done. They can't just jump in a moment's notice. They're going to have patience.
Right. As soon as he feels that he's got control down the line of these people, because we're going to make the point to them, these people are out of control, and if they continue out of control, that means you're letting them be out of control because you have a direct line right through your cabinet right down to control these federal agencies and these federal agents.
That's right.
And if they're out of order, you need to fix them. But, you know, we're going to wait in a little while. I believe he knows that, and I believe in due time he's going to do what has to be done, and we're going to help him to understand to some degree what needs to be done too. So.
Well, he's already said that he's going to release them. I suppose that he's got an agenda all set for what he has to get done and what he will be doing. And I would imagine that those guys are involved. You know, they're in that agenda because he's made a big deal out of it.
All right, well, we'll wait till next week, see what comes up then, and over the next few weeks, and we'll see what happens. So, all right, thank you, Robert.
Yeah.
Did we find Ollie?
Yes, I unmuted him.
Hello, do you hear me?
No, we can't hear you, Ollie.
Okay. Hey, I want to talk about Jeanette Finnegan a minute. Years and years ago, we were due to pull in New York City for 3 weeks, and a small farm boy from Colorado, I had no idea what to expect. As it turned out, I met some very awesome people there. But anyway, when I found out Jeanette was going to be at that meeting, I PM'd her on Facebook, and I said, Jeanette, you're going to meet some NL guys that I've worked with for years. They are very good guys. In fact, Gerard grew up working with horses, and they're very anxious to meet you and Charisse. And she says, love you, Ollie. Thank you. And I said, you're going to have a good time there. And she says, I really think I am. So, but let me tell you what, These are the end times. Old souls are being attracted to each other. Old souls are meeting each other. And when you look into that woman's eyes, you're going to see an old friend. And you're going to realize at some point that this meeting was ordained. And if you've got any doubt at all that you're not in a spiritual mission, that will answer a lot of questions. Now, I was talking to Jan. I says, hey, you need a camera crew there. We need some video. We can put that into one of our newscasts.
We got a guy up this way that records a lot of stuff. He's in my local Liberty group, and he's coming to both meetings we're having on Friday, and he also went out on Facebook to let them know that he's coming out. His name is Phil, and he'll bring his cameras. We'll be talking with him tomorrow. Gerard, did you get a hold of him yet? He'll love to film this. Matter of fact, I know he's going to bring his cameras because that's what he does on filming.
I didn't call him, I PM'd him on Facebook, but I will call him. I'll call him tomorrow. Okay. I don't know if I can call him tonight.
He's going to bring his cameras, and for us to invite him with his cameras, he's going to love it even more because he's getting good at the cameras and filming.
He always tapes. He tapes everything.
Yeah. So anyway, we will get
so
that.
Anyway, like I say, you're going to enjoy that very much, and yeah, you know, it's an event, and anybody in that area, I would encourage you. Jan said he's driving 4 hours down. I thought it would be well worth the drive. And anybody up there that can make that meeting and meet the Finicum gals, they really need to do it, because it's part of the big plan. I guarantee you. Okay. Also, I've made a lot of progress with my virtual studios. I bought one yesterday. It was just perfect. I paid $80 for it, but it's got several camera angles, and I just sent some pictures to Jan and Gerard. But also, I've got some software. It's professional software. It's got a steep learning curve. It's going to take me a while to figure it out, but it's going to do chroma key and a lot. Then I got a device in today, HDMI to USB, where I can live stream with my webcam. Actually, use it a live stream up to YouTube with my Tandy cam, a Sony camera. So I'm making progress. It's slow, but we'll gradually get that together, and we'll be putting out some good videos, some good newscasts. I yield.
I make a motion we make Ollie our media czar.
They'll get him a press pass, right?
I'm telling you what, he's like on fire here. He's spending all his money.
You're
going to
catch him
press
pass?
On carrot. Oh, yeah.
Okay, anyone else out there that we need to talk to, Jan?
That's the only ones that I had heard that had something they wanted to offer tonight.
Gerard, you got anything before I move on?
No, move on.
MoveOn.org, okay. All right, I'm going to pass the panel over to Gerard in a minute or two, but first let me introduce Brent Winters, author of Excellence in Common Law, and his website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic. What are you going to talk to us about tonight? And Gerard, you got the panel, right?
When Brent gets done, we open up the queue, we'll mix it up. In other words, if you got questions for Brent, you can get in there. If you got questions for NLA, just say who you want to answer the question before you ask
right.
it. Okay,
We're in the lecture mode right now, so when Brent's done, move over to the Q&A mode on the left side, okay?
Okay, very good.
Brent,
thanks.
You got the mic?
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Here I am again, and we're still talking about the militia of the several states, the four militia clauses, and we're getting close to the end. I went through what I'd had on the subject, and at the end of my little booklet on the militia of the several states, I have a model militia statute. Under the four militia clauses of our Constitution, there are four classes of people. Well, there's the presidents. That's one class of people. Then there are the congressmen. That's another class. They have responsibilities the Constitution delegates to them concerning the militia of the several states, as do the that class of folks called the presidents. So the presidents, the congressmen. And then there's that class of folks called the state legislature. And they have responsibility. The Constitution says exactly what they're supposed to do. And within the bailiwick of their responsibilities is to pass legislation so that the militiamen in their state will have, well, they'll have a law, a more particular law. And the Constitution requires that. And it flat hasn't been done. Now, in a lot of state constitutions mention the militia. Some of them in quite a bit of detail. And I even know one fellow from one state who, when he was born, he was given a militia district number. When he was born, on his birth certificate. So it's the machinery is still in place in many ways. But if all the machinery, all the legislation, all the rules, whatever government does to make the militia work effectively, if all that's taken away, it doesn't take away the requirements that the Constitution puts upon the presidents, the congressmen, and state legislators. They're still there, and the militia, by the way, is still there. It's still there. Can't get rid of it. Armed or unarmed, witting or unwitting, cognizant of what they're supposed to do, or clueless, like most people are today, plumb clueless, that our Constitution has four militia clauses. Of course, people are mostly, anymore, familiar with the fourth militia clause called the Second Amendment. That's the other class of folk, is the militiamen themselves. And the first three militia clauses delegate duties to presidents, congressmen, state legislators. The last militia clause delegates nothing but guarantees protection of the most fundamental element, part, that even enables the militia to be a reality. Even it's a reality that enables them to do their job. And that's the right to keep and carry a gun. This is not a mystery. That people argue about it is buffoonery. That arguments go on in the courts. Of course, I suppose you could maybe take notice of the fact that much of what's argued in the courts by supposedly the best brains in the legal profession would be obvious to a third grade child. You're just arguing the obvious often. We see that with the Second Amendment. The right, it is a duty. It's what a right is in old Anglo speech, and it remains the same today. A duty to carry a gun. It's a duty. And all the things that governments do to try to license the duty and regulate the duty, regulate it not in the constitutional sense of the word regulate, but in the bureaucratic sense. There's a difference between the two, vast difference. But all of the infringement, that means to nibble around the edges. It's worse now than nibbling around the edges. Consider, for instance, carrying firearms across state lines. The Sullivan Act back in the 1930s, Congress decided they would restrict the carrying of firearms across state lines. Well, that's a violation of the Constitution. They said you can't take a machine gun across state lines without our permission. And, of course, they weren't about to give it. And all of those things, and that's just the beginnings, of course, all of those things are infringements and haven't changed things. As a matter of fact, things have become much, much worse. The things that the Sullivan Act claimed to stop did not stop. Well, going through this model militia statute, let me pick up where I left off last time. just reading through it, making a few comments. This is a model. It's not held out to be perfect. I put it together over a long period of time, tried to think through it. I was reading through it here a little bit ago before we started this call, and I noticed some things that I thought were unclear. I made some changes. I'm always changing my words. My words aren't perfect. Whether I'm speaking or writing, I lisp and stammer, and then when I go to write, I think I've said something. I go back and read it the next day and realize I haven't said anything. I worked and sweated over it, and I got some ideas on paper. But at any rate, I just keep trying to smith it, wordsmith it. Paragraph 10 of this model state militia statute. By the way, you can find that in the booklet at commonlawyer.com. Go to the books button and click on it. There's a book there called The Militia of the Several States, Our Constitution's Answer to Its Enemies. You can also get it, I believe, at Amazon.com. Just type in my name, Brent Allen Winters, and all the books will come up. This militia book is among them. But paragraph 10 says this, organization and choosing of officers. For purposes of organizing this state's militia, the governor shall divide this state into three blocks of equally numbered contiguous counties, each of these three divisions having numerically equal numbers of counties as close as is possible, and with the boundary lines between these three divisions running along a line as true east and west as these counties' boundaries shall allow, a northern division, a middle division, and a southern division. Paragraph 11. The governor of this state shall be this state's militia commander in chief, and shall appoint, with the advice and consent of the state senate, one general militia officer to be his immediate commander of this state's militia. Paragraph 12. After 30 days, but before 60 days of the enactment of this state militia statute, the militiamen, having been placed on the rolls of each township, shall elect by majority vote their own township's militia officers. Each militiaman of each township shall be entitled to one vote for any officer of this statute, any officer of this statute empowers him to choose. The bodily presence of three-quarters of a township's or county's enrolled militiamen shall constitute a quorum for purposes of any vote taken to choose officers. Vote by proxy, telephone, mail, email, or any other way than by secret ballot of those personally present shall never be allowed. Paragraph 13. The enrolled militiamen of each township shall elect and appoint at the time and place their township supervisor designates, by secret written ballot, one officer at the head of their township. Paragraph 14. The militiamen of each township shall be divided into companies according as near as possible to contiguous precincts within each township, with the militiamen, plural, in electing an officer for each company, defined as follows. Paragraph 15. Each township supervisor shall divide his township's precincts into contiguous groupings in fulfillment of this statute. Each company shall choose its own officer to be under the command of that township's officer. Paragraph 16. Thus, any township enrolling 100 militiamen or less shall constitute one company under the command of the township officer of their choosing. Any township enrolling 101 to 200 militiamen shall constitute two companies of equal numbers, or as nearly equal as possible. Townships enrolling 201 to 300 militiamen shall divide into companies of equal numbers, or as nearly equal as possible, with each company choosing its own officer to be under the command of the township officer. Townships enrolling 301 to 400 militiamen shall divide into three companies of equal numbers, or as nearly equal as possible, with each company choosing its own officer to be under the command of the township officer, and so on, has more numbers of enrolled militiamen required. Paragraph 17. Each company officer shall further divide his company into squads of 12, and he, and no other, shall choose and appoint one petty officer over each squad for squad leader. 18. Township officers, upon being chosen and appointed, shall, within 1 month of their appointment and by the governor's writ, designating the time, assemble at their county's courthouse, and shall each cast one secret ballot for commanding officer of their county's militia. The bodily presence of 3/4 of a county's enrolled militiamen shall constitute a quorum for purposes of this vote. Vote by proxy, telephone, email, mail, or any other way other than secret ballot of those personally present shall never be allowed. Paragraph 19. As soon as ballots are counted and the results determined, the man receiving the most ballots shall be the commanding officer of that county's militia. Each ballot shall be counted in the sight of each of the militiamen having voted, and he shall acknowledge the person chosen on each ballot. Paragraph 20. Within another 30 days of the conclusion of the deadline for electing commanding officers for each county, all such county commanding officers, by the governor's writ designating the time, shall assemble at the state capitol building, where each officer shall cast his secret ballot for an officer to serve over his division of contiguous counties, as the state legislature has provided for herein, and directly under the governor and his appointed state militia commanding officer. You see, if you're able to follow this, the officers of the militia is organized, the state's militia is organized from the bottom up. It is not organized from the top down. The governor does appoint his commander of the state's militia under him as commander-in-chief. But then the men bring it up from the bottom, appoint their officers precinct by precinct, squad by squad, squad leaders, and then officers at the precinct level, then officers at the county level, or the township level, then officers at the state level. And then once it's organized at the base, then they can choose their officers on up the line. Paragraph 21. The bodily presence of 3/4 of the state's county militia commanding officers shall constitute a quorum for purposes of this vote. Vote by proxy, telephone, email, mail, or any other way than secret written ballot of those present shall never be allowed. No more militia officers other than these designated above shall be chosen and appointed. So really, you've got some petty officers for squad leaders, and then precinct leaders, county officers, and then officers of the division of the states. And these are all, this is a model. States would do it differently. Some are larger, some smaller, some states have counties of various sizes. Not all do, but some do. And all of these details, the state legislature would have to hammer out. But when they go to do things like that, when men legislate, in most cases, they don't draft legislation out of whole cloth. They find something somewhere that they can use as a template to get the language going, and then try to organize it and change it the way that would suit them. When our Continental Army, which was made up of militiamen from each of the colonies, and then a regular army was formed, but they didn't have a law to govern the army. So George Washington was most familiar, having been a British officer. He took the king's regulations and adopted them as is for the law of the Army of the United States. Of course, he took any references to King George out and replaced it with appropriate names or appropriate offices. But it's worked very well. It worked very well for the United States for a long time, and we are a product of Britain. And so that's what made our, by the way, our war with Britain, and the result after that made it worthwhile. If you notice, France had a revolution, and it turned into a bloody, chaotic mess where the blood ran as deep as a man's ankles in the streets of Paris. They were chopping men's heads off and women's heads and children's heads so fast it'd make your head spin. And things after the revolution didn't get better, they got worse. Same thing is true of all South American countries. Same thing's true all over the world. It's nothing but revolution, counter-revolution. I know a fella down in, his daughter married a friend of mine down in Brazil, and he was involved in the revolution down there, a coup not too many years ago. And it was a violent thing, and people were killed, and he felt like he was on the right side, and he probably was, and they prevailed. They prevailed. And now he's asking himself, for what? What good did it do? Almost as fast as they had won, the politics flipped, and the same kind of vermin were back in office. Didn't take long. That's the way it is when you live under the law of the city. But in a common law country, traditionally, if we can keep the forms of our common law, that won't be the case. We can really make changes, and we have a structure. We're not trying to get rid of our structure, our forms, our common law forms. We want to keep them. We want to reestablish them every time there's a peaceful revolution, as we've just experienced. And we're not trying to look forward and forget the past. No, we're trying to reestablish something always, constantly. Reestablish something from the past that was good that's been lost. The revolutions, so in that sense, our break from Britain wasn't a revolution. The rest of the world has had the Russian Revolution, the Papal Revolution. Well, the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, all the other revolutions of Europe arose out of what historians call the Papal Revolution. And even ours, I suppose, in some ways, but we rejected. We rejected what Rome had done. That's ultimately what happened. This was the conclusion of Harold Berryman, a rather complicated book. I advise it to people to have time to read. The name of the book is Of Law and Revolution, I believe. Big, thick thing. Big, thick thing. Berryman's gone now, but he had a way of being, he just leaned conservative, and he really wanted to get to the bottom of things. He compiled so much in that book that it's impossible to organize it. That was my opinion after I read it, but I sure did pick up a lot of good information. Well, back to the state militia statute. Number 22, calling out and mustering into actual service. This state's legislature shall provide criteria mandatory for the governor of this state to use in deciding whether or not any purported necessity warrants calling out the militia of this state or any part of it. Now, this is the Constitution's pattern. The Constitution says that Congress shall set the standard whereby the president evaluates, the test whereby he must evaluate and discern whether or not he must call out the militia of any of the states or any part of them in whole or in part. That's Congress's job. The militia clauses of our Constitution say that. Congress hasn't done that for many, many decades. It's their duty. And if they're not going to do their duty, they need to be removed from office. Well, modeling after that, though, I say the state's legislature should do the same thing for the governor, because the governor is not under the control of Congress. He's under the law of the state, and the state's legislature shall provide this criteria that he is to use as a test when deciding whether or not necessity warrants calling out to the militia of this state or any part of it. You see, the governor of the state, if he wants to call out the militia, he doesn't have to call it all out. He can just call out part of it if he wanted to. Depends on what he wants to do. Paragraph 23. The governor of this state may summon and muster the militia of this state or any part of it into actual service to execute the laws of this state, the laws of the United States, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, but only according to the criteria this state's legislature has previously provided for the governor to use to make such a decision. Now, this language echoes the language of our Constitution. The only reason the president can call out the militia the Constitution provides the reasons, and they are to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections and repel invasions. Those three and no others, those three and no more. But those are the reasons. The criteria he is to use, our Constitution says Congress must give him a criteria. That means a way of deciding whether or not insurrection indeed exists. How do you define insurrection? Well, that's Congress's duty to define insurrection. And they're supposed to do it, by the way, according to the common law, because that's our word in the Constitution. And like all words in our Constitution, all concepts in our United States Constitution, they're not defined. They're not explained. Our Constitution is a brief of common law government at every point. And without the common law to inform the definitions, our Constitution is a dry and dispirited skeleton of words. It means nothing. Well, the same thing's true here, I suppose. I'm trying to write it the same way because of the common law pertains in the states, with the exception of Louisiana. But even there, the common law of the Supreme Court of the United States overlays everything they do. It's the relationship with Louisiana and the government of the United States is much like the relationship of Scotland. It's not the same, but it's like it in a way, the relationship of Scotland with England. Scotland is its own country, but at the same time, the Parliament passes laws that apply in Scotland. Scotland's not a common law country. Scotland's under the Roman Code. Scotland never has been a common law country. And that's one of the reasons why there's been such terrible struggles up there, because those people, being British, they've wanted the same kind of ideas of the common law, but they were never able to really enjoy them the same. And that is the relationship, in a way, that Quebec has in Canada with the general government up there and Louisiana has here. Well, paragraph 24. In no event shall any militiaman be summoned and mustered to the service of the United States other than to, number one, execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. That's a quote from the United States Constitution. And what, well, that's, by the way, Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16, but the state militia, the reason we have militias that are subject to governors and they are local militias is to put a check on the federal government. And if the President of the United States wants to muster the militia to do something that does not amount to executing the laws of the Union, suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasions, it's up to the officers of the states to say, no, we're not coming. Now, if you can show us how we're doing one of these three things, we'll be glad to show up. That is why our Constitution requires that the states, either by their legislature or by a vote of the militiamen or by appointment of the governor, however they choose to do it, the states choose the officers of the state militia. The president doesn't have that power. Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, he's a graduate of West Point. And the president, one of the presidents, tried to appoint him and give him a position over the militia when called into actual service. State militias. Militias are state militias in America. There are no other kind. There is no federal militia in America. Our Constitution never acknowledges such a thing. But Jefferson Davis said, no, I won't accept. He said, why not? He said, well, it's clear. The Constitution says the president doesn't have the power to appoint officers of the militia of the states. Well, he was right, and he didn't accept. But the federal government, just by doing it, if nobody complains forever, expands their jurisdiction and power that way. The federal courts do the same thing. We see it happening right in front of us right now. They just do it. And if we don't scream and holler and say no, and I'm talking about the militia, that's their job, and the officers, and the men. But also it is a principle that applies across the board. Justice Scalia, before either he was killed or died, but he said one time, that people often write him letters all from all over the country and say to him, protect states' rights. You're not doing enough to protect states' rights. And he said publicly, instead of writing a lot of letters, he said, I want to do that as much as possible, but you're looking to the wrong place. And he said, if you haven't noticed, my paycheck comes from the Treasury of the United States. It doesn't come from some state legislature someplace or some state treasury. And all these justices up here and all of the federal bench are paid by the federal government. And he called them, in one opinion, back in 2004, he called the federal judges lone employees of the state. In the context, he was saying, that's why we have jury trial, because otherwise you'd be subject to a lone employee of the state for your faith, of your life, liberty, or property, or any combination of the three, of losing it. But he said, we look to the state, our Constitution is right. I think it is. The Constitution establishes the states to protect their rights. And it's up to every person, it's up to every branch of government to protect its jurisdiction and bailiwick. The courts, the Supreme Court, should not depend upon Congress to protect its jurisdiction. If it does, it'll lose it all. And Congress should not depend upon the Supreme Court and the President to protect its jurisdiction. If it does, it's going to lose its jurisdiction and power, as has happened, by the way, in the past. When, for example, back in the reign of Franklin Roosevelt, Congress just turned it all over to him. They didn't do anything. They gave up their jurisdiction, and by the way, it's been gone ever since the 1930s, ever since the New Deal, ever since the burden for challenging federal law and regulation is on the challenger now instead of on the government to justify what they're doing. It's on the challenger, us, to overcome the presumption of the rightness of bureaucratic rules. That's madness. But that's the way it is now. But the point is, every person, that goes for you too in your own house. If you're not willing to defend your rights, that is your duties under God, nobody else is going to do it for you. And even if you hire a lawyer to do it, he can't do a very good job unless you work with him, just like a doctor can't heal you unless you work with him. It's up to every person to defend their own rights and the states to defend their rights, not a federal government. They ought to try, but they don't. They don't. They want more power. They're selfish. Well, that's we're going to get next time, Lord willing. The next paragraph, paragraph 25, is all about training and how to pay the militia. And that's only two paragraphs, and we're done. Then we're getting into just some final words there I want to say about the militia. But we're almost at the end of this subject, and then we can start a new one. That's all I have this evening, John or Gerard, whoever's there. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay. Anybody has any questions for Mr. Brent Winters? Get in the queue. If you have any questions for NLA, for me, or one of the other leaders, go ahead and ask it. Just let us know ahead of time. Okay. We have Mike. Let me know what state you're in, Mike. I'm going to unmute you there.
New York.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mike. Get back in the queue, Mike. Mike, get back in the queue and I'll unmute you. I'm sorry. Okay, well, actually, right now, New Jersey, Terry, you're open, so you might as well go ahead, and then Mike is next.
Yeah, I had a question for Brent with regard to the fact that it's often said that when you go before a judge and he says, do you understand, that he's really saying, do you stand under me? And I looked at a Black Law Dictionary, which was online. It didn't have prior definitions, and it basically said what the common understanding is, that, but not that the judge, that you stand under the judge. But I noticed that from my experience with regard to the court of record, that they changed the definition between the third and the fourth edition. Is that, when the judge said, do you understand, what is he really saying?
He's really covering his own backside, so that whatever he does, he's got it on the record that you understand. No, he's not saying, do you stand under? I don't believe a judge has the skills of etymology to even think about such things. Most judges, maybe some do, I don't know, but I don't think it ever crosses their mind. Understanding does mean it does mean it's a preposition, under, and stand, it means to stand under, but what, of course, the word means is that you have a foundation for what you're thinking. That's what understanding means, and it's always meant that. I've never known it to mean anything else, and I don't think the judges, no, they're not trying to parse words. They're not trying to fool you. What they're trying to do when they say that is cover themselves, because if you say, I was in court one time, and the lawyer was indicted, and the magistrate was arraigning him, and he said, do you understand the indictment? He said, no, I don't. I don't. And he was upset, of course. And so the judge said, well, I'm going to read it. And it took 45 minutes or more. It was a long read. It makes judges mad when they do that, when you say you don't understand. But see, that magistrate wanted to cover his backside so that when it went up on appeal, if it did, had it on the record, he said he understood. And if he says he doesn't understand, then he'll read it for you. And then if you say you don't understand, then he'll try to get some lawyer to explain it to you, anything, so that you understand. Because if you... Usually a judge will say that when he's trying to get you to make a decision about something, a plea bargain. Do you accept this plea bargain? Or do you understand that you're waiving your rights and if you do any of those things without understanding, knowing, the old English word we sometimes use, still use it, wittingly, that means knowingly. And that knowingly means with understanding, with a foundation for what you know, for a foundation for your conclusions. If you have that, then whatever you decide to do is binding. If you make a decision, for example, plea bargain, you don't do it or waive a right. I waive my right to read the indictment, Your Honor. If you don't do that understandingly, wittingly, knowingly, then it doesn't count, and they got to go back and do it again. You see, that word understanding is all about due process. It's part of due process. If you don't understand what's going on in court, then due process hasn't been served. So an important part of due process, and as we like to say, our common law doesn't contain due process. Due process is not part of our common law. Our common law is due process. It's a process-oriented tradition. It's not a result-oriented tradition like the rest of the world, like Islam, like Romanism, like Judaism. The law of the city governs every country in the world, and it's not about process. They focus on the result. We've got to achieve, in this dispute, before the tribunal, we must achieve the result that the government, by its legislation, demands. That's all they think about. And they think that's wonderful, because it brings incredible order. Well, of course it brings order. As long as there's a dictator or one will, a legislature having a combined will, making commands, and everybody has to conform to it, come hell or high water, no matter what your circumstances are, well, that brings order. You know, Hitler did have order. Mussolini got order, and every bureaucrat wants order. If you go to federal or state prison, they're going to have order. Everybody's going to conform. If you're in the military service, there's order. You must conform. It makes no difference how tall, short, or smart you are, or dumb. You will conform to the same thing. But here, in our common law country, we're not under martial law like the rest of the world is. That's all the law of the city is. It's just martial law. Just obey. Everybody conform. Uniformity is the byword. And that's why that there's not that much creativity in those places. There's not that much prosperity. There's not that much wealth. Anyways, now it comes down to due process. So when they say, do you understand everything in our courts? No. It's bad. We see how bad our federal courts are, and we're watching the madness. And the courts are independent. They can do and say anything they want. That's fundamental to our common law tradition, by the way. But what the courts don't have, and this is not what's being said, it should be said, the courts have no power. None. Almost none. I mean, the judges have power over the marshals in the courtroom. That's true. But outside of that courtroom, they don't have any power. President Trump, he can just do what he wants. The courts can say what they want. That's their job. It's their job to make a finding. No, they don't make law. They make a finding. Isn't that what we always say? They have an opinion. Well, that's what it is. And they can say what they want. And they cannot be meddled with as a matter of common law standard by anybody else in government. And if that ever happens, we're done. I don't care how crazy they get. And I agree, they are crazy. But that doesn't mean the president has to do what they say. It doesn't mean Congress has to do what they say. It doesn't mean anybody has to do what they say. If they're wrong, they're wrong. Now, that means you've got to have enough guts and conviction to live with the consequences. And that's what makes freedom when men are willing to do that. They're willing to live with the consequences of choosing what's right no matter what. But the president's in a position, fortunately, that's the way our Constitution has established it, to where he has enough power that he doesn't have to do what they say. They're not going to jail him, and they're not going to overcome him by force. He has aircraft carriers, the Marine Corps, all the armed FBI, bureaucrats, Border Patrol, all that. And Congress, of course, they have the power of legislation, and that's power. But it isn't the power the president has. But all of these branches of government, and the courts included, the courts are to ensure, not the result. That we don't live in a law of the city, a civil law country. It is not their job to ensure a result. It is the court's job, and we need to say it loudly. We need to say it often because they forget. We forget. They just get too used to it. They get too used to it, and they're tired. Judges get tired. Well, of course, when they get tired, they should quit. But for some reason, well, I know why they don't do it. Well, they want that security, that paycheck, and retirement. It's too bad it works out that way. But when they're tired, they should quit. But they're tired, and they get, so they just want to can people. Get them in the can, put them in jail, whatever they want to do. Reach the result they want. It's the court's job to ensure that due process is followed. It's the court's job to focus everyone concerned, focus them on a course. Don't look at the end. Just stay the course. What does due process require? It requires that everyone who waives a right, everyone who, well, I'm making a plea bargain, is waiving a right. You're waiving your right to trial by jury. Everyone who does something before the court makes a decision does it knowingly. That means understandingly. That means that they have the reasons at the foundation for their conclusions. That's what that means. For what it's worth, that's the way I've always understood it, to use that word again.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Glad you brought it up.
Thank you, Terry.
It's important to be said, yeah. It's what makes it worth when people start asking questions.
That's right.
Yeah.
Next question is from Mike. You've been unmuted, Mike. Go ahead.
Hello, man. Thank you very much for taking my call. Brett, I have two questions for you. Last week, you were speaking on the oath of office of the president and the vice president. Mm-hmm. And with the difference between the two, that you, I correct me if I'm wrong, I think you said that the president doesn't have control over the militia. And it was the vice president because of his oath of office where he took the test by his pledge against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So in that event, does he have the control over the militias? And is that only the federal militias or the military, like the National Guard, or the unorganized militia? And where would who's in charge of the unorganized militia in New York?
Well, first, the word unorganized militia is not in our Constitution's contemplation. Neither is the word organized militia. All those things arose within the last 125 years. I don't think we should talk that way. It doesn't exist in constitutional contemplation. But I realize our culture has foisted those words on us. I'm not faulting you for saying it. I'm just saying we constantly, men do govern by words, and the way we talk does make a difference. And we should say what is constitutional and speak in constitutional terms. And number one, I can't remember, of course. I'd like to say I didn't say the president has no control of the militia. I don't believe he does, but I didn't go back and listen. I may have said that and didn't know it, but I didn't intend to. Now, let me go over that again. That's important. I'm glad you brought it up, too. Again, it's when we start thinking. Go ahead.
What you said, Brent, was that the vice president is part of the militia.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I did say that.
But the president is not, because he's the commander-in-chief of the militia.
Oh, good. I remember saying that. Yeah.
I think you misunderstood him. I remember what he said.
Well,
go ahead.
If one guy misunderstood all, it should be said again, because maybe there's others. The president of the United States takes a different oath than the vice president. Maybe somebody had noticed that. And the difference was, as Mike said, the vice president took an oath to support and defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. That's the same oath that I took when I was sworn in as a lawyer, and the same oath I took when I was a military fella, and the same oath I took when I was sworn in as a temporary county attorney. And it's all the same, because John read it while ago. It's right on the Constitution. Everybody that's an officer of government, if it's state or federal, takes that oath. Ought to. But the president of the United States takes an oath that says he'll support the Constitution, and doesn't use the phrases against enemies, foreign and domestic. That's the president doesn't do that. And if something, God forbid, should happen to D.J. Trump, then if Pence were to become president, he would have to take that oath. The oath he took as vice president wouldn't count. He'd have to take the president's oath. It's a little different. The reason the president doesn't say that he will defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, because he's not potentially a member of the militia. He's the commander of the militia when called out into actual service, as the Constitution puts it, when he calls them out. He does have the power to call them out. There are no federal militias in America. There is only the militia of the several states. That means each of the states independently. That's important. That puts the states in control, and the feds have to bow to their wishes, and there is a check there to keep everybody's responsible to do the constitutional thing and not respond to a president who tries to call out the militia to fight his political battles, for example, which would happen real quick. The National Guard's called out to do all sorts of crazy things, have been in the past anyway, that didn't have anything to do with what the Constitution requires. Of course, they're not the militia. That's the other side of it. But I'm just saying those things would happen. Armed force is armed force, and political leaders want to use it. I've seen it misused. It's terrible what they do sometimes. But the president and the vice president take a different oath because they have different responsibilities. Mike Pence is in the same position I am. He's part of the militia. He's not the president. He's not the commander of the militia. He doesn't have any duties at all, frankly. Really, all Mike Pence has is he's just supposed to be ready. Supposed to be ready. I know he has unofficial duties, but duties of the vice president. Oh, he has some official. He did break a tie the other day. Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, the president is the one that does the mustering, the calling out mustering, according to the criteria Congress gives him. And the rest of us, including Mike Pence, are members of the militia. So we have a duty to defend against enemies, foreign and domestic. There are two duties in government, two fundamental duties, those and no other, those and no more. Again, make it simple. The only duties the Bible authorizes, and the only duties really the Constitution authorizes, are national defense, and jury duty. Jury duty. In other words, government, and the jury is the foundation of all government. The jury of 12 men, the foundation of all government, and those two duties have always anciently been the duties of what we now call the militia. In old Anglo-Dane England, they called it the Ferd. F-Y-R-D. And the Ferd Fair, F-Y-R-D, F-A-R-E, was the Militia A-Goin. The Militia A-Goin, Fair. That's the old word for going. We'd say the militia mobilized the Ferd Fair. Well, they swore an oath way back then, way before Magna Carta. And their oath was to support and defend the law of the land. And the land, it included both, because our common law of the land, same thing, new process, same thing again. Arise, listen to this close, this may be new, they arise out of the land. That was their belief. That was their belief. You say, that sounds funny. That's why they called it the law of the land, by the way. And attached to the land. Well, no, it's not so far-fetched, because God teaches the same thing in the Bible. The law rises as to us out of the land. It comes from the skies, comes from the heavens, and it finds its source in the Messiah of God, who received it by appointment and delegation from that other member of the Godhead, God the Father. That's what the Bible teaches. And that's why they believe that. And that's why we still call it the law of the land. We've forgotten the reason why, just as we have forgotten the reason why we say enemies foreign and domestic. Because the militiaman's duty is to do two things. The duties of government are two. Foreign against enemies foreign is armed defense. Against enemies domestic is to be willing to serve upon the jury and defend the rights, the land rights, and the rights of land and law of the land. That's what that's all about. That's why we take that oath yet today. It's sad, as all things, that men do not have, bring back this word from that other question, men do not have understanding. In other words, they do not know the reason they say those words. Now, I hope, maybe, Mike Pence knows the reason, but I doubt if he does, because then it's not really all of our everybody's fault that we don't know the reason, because those charged with teaching and preserving our rights and our understanding have been lazy and foolish and thick and slow and stupid, and they are not the teachers. You know, the judges are supposed to teach us. That's what the Bible says. In their judgments, they are teaching. And then if they throw in a little extra, if they're really in a good spirit, it's a good thing. They teach, because to know right from wrong, as the law of the land defines it, is important, as our Constitution defines it. But they have not been teaching. You know, when you go to jury duty, sometimes a judge will give a charge to the jury and he'll instruct. That means he's supposed to not tell them what to do. He's supposed to tell them the nature of their job, the standards, the criteria, the history of the jury, why it's important. I've been in courtrooms where state judges have done that. It's what judges are supposed to do. And it, to have understanding, to know the reasons why we have this conclusion that we should have this oath, it puts meaning to it. By the way, this oath that we defend our law of the land, and that's what our Constitution says it is, the law of the land, just like the ancient oath for Magna Carta, the Anglos, the Danes, even the Celts used to take, strikingly alike, Adrian Sidney says, in their particulars of their law. He said, just like that, well, I forgot where I was going with that statement, but to come back to the bottom line, it's good to have understanding. I don't know what it was now. That oath does not give a duty to a judge. The judge takes the oath of support to defend the Constitution, an attorney takes it, an office holder takes it. That does not give a duty to that person that person did not have already have. It did not bind him to any additional duty. It only additionally bound him to a duty he already possessed. What American does not have a duty before God, for crying out loud, by virtue of his birth? What American does not have a duty to support and defend the law of the land? And the law of the land is older than our Constitution. The principles of our Constitution are our common law. All they did was write it down so it would be frozen in place, and we can go back and refer to it. It is the law that they had always before, and that their ancestors, their forebears, had for generations and hundreds, even a thousand or 2 years that we know of. The principles of it, the first principles. And so it's good to have understanding. Understanding. Why am I saying these things when I take that oath? Somebody needs to tell somebody. And that question arose. It rises sometimes. It just didn't come out of whole cloth. There's reasons we do what we do if we look for them. That one is hard to find, though. You can't even find it in the literature. It's out there, but if you run across it, you're fortunate. Well, thanks for the question.
Okay, the other thing I had was, in the New York State, where would we be able to locate our local militia? How would we contact them in order to be a part of them?
You are a part of the militia. You don't. The militia in most of America doesn't know it exists. And they don't understand the militia is. It just is. It encompasses all able-bodied males or males that can serve on the jury. That's what the militia is. That's what it's always been. It's never changed. And the folks that drafted and ratified our Constitution had those very things in mind, just the way I said it. When they penned those words, they didn't explain them because everybody understood them. There, if you go to try to contact the militia, just go to your neighbor. That's him. There he is. He's one of them. But probably in your state, I'm not from New York, but if it's like most states, they have done what Justice Joseph Story said he was afraid above all things would happen. 175 years ago, he said this. He said he was afraid that we would ignore these four militia clauses, and we would not, our state legislature would not pass legislation requiring and putting machinery in place to require the enrollment so that you would have local officers that you could report to, and that in case of an emergency that you could be utilized and put to helping people in cases of catastrophe, hurricane, flood, earthquake, poverty, whatever the local folk would want to do. I like to analogize the militia to local volunteer fire departments. It's kind of the same thing. I know where I'm from, the volunteer fire departments always were there to help people. They would help widows. I mentioned widows. They would help widows. I remember one lady that lived in town. She was the only black woman in town. And I won't tell your name because it wouldn't be politically acceptable today, but everybody loved her. She was a nurse, a trained nurse, and she did a lot in the local community. Doctors weren't easy to get at. Everybody loved her. Well, anyway, the fire department, when she got to where she could work like she used to, the fire department built her a house to live in. They did it because they were, in effect, the local militia. They were the militia. They didn't call themselves that. They didn't organize with weapons. But the militia are the people. The Constitution, our Constitution says, we the people. And I'll repeat it again. It bears repeating. Those of you that have heard me say it, just bear with me. The phrase the people is from our culture. It was lifted out of the Bible, the phrase the people. It translates the Hebrew phrase, ha'am, always translates the people. I just went through 159 times in the Old Testament the phrase ha'am occurs. It's one word in the Hebrew, the article, the word ha'am. It means the people. It always, in every instance, signifies an armed band of men. Sometimes it signifies an entire army of a country other than Israel. For example, 180,000 Assyrians. But when it's used concerning God's people, it always refers to be particular of the Old Testament. The militia, the 12 several tribes of Israel, each organized separately, and the book of Numbers and the Bible details, not only that, the book of Exodus gives us a lot of details, and some in Deuteronomy, but Numbers especially details the rules of the militia. And our militia clauses track those. The words the people, refer to that class of persons we today call the militia. And that is what those who drafted our Constitution, those who ratified it, they didn't give it a thought. That's what they had in mind when they used that phrase, the people. It does not refer to everybody. There are other words for that in the Bible also. The word translated congregation is the other word.
What's that word in Hebrew again? Can you spell it?
I can spell it in English. Well, I can spell it in which you, Hebrew or English? Which one do you like?
Well, in English.
Ha, and am would be am. The word am means, or we translate it, people. It refers to the males. Able-bodied, above age 20, by the way. And ha is the definite article in the Hebrew tongue. Ha-am. Ha-am.
And, H-A-A-M.
Yeah. If you go to Young's Concordance,
okay.
Young's, or Strong's, you can go to Strong's Concordance. Strong's is more exhaustive, but Young's is a good one. Of the Bible, you can look up the word people, and you'll find that word am. We'll have it there, I'm sure. And also the phrase my people, and also the phrase your people refers, when it says my people, it's always referring to the militia of the 12 several tribes of Israel. Fascinating. For example, and this is important to understand the Old Testament, you can't really grasp people miss you so much. That famous verse, 2 Chronicles 7:14, you hear the evangelicals quoting it all the time. I don't fault them for quoting it. By the way, I mean, whatever an evangelical is, but it's a very popular verse among Christian people. If my people hear my voice and humble themselves and pray, that's not written to women. And if all the women in America humbled themselves and prayed, it wouldn't change our circumstances. It's a good thing that the female of our species does that, but that's not what that verse says. That verse is talking about the males, the militia. humbling themselves and praying and seeking God. And when men do that, when the male of our species do that, things might change. But all too often, many males, do make the mistake that Adam did. They follow their wives until their wives follow them. And they follow their wives, and it causes all sorts of trouble, but that's something we can talk about at some other time. But the point, it is important to government. We're talking about government here. And unless things aren't right between men and women, I say this a lot because it's fundamental. It's right in the beginning. It's the key point for the whole Bible, to government. The Bible is a book of legal significance. And at the very bottom of it is the government of the family. If the government of the family, that starts with the man and the woman. If it's not there, there will be no government in the White House or in the State House that amounts to anything. And it comes down to the men. The men must take the bull by the horn. The men must do their duty, and they aren't. And the ladies suffer from it, frankly. The female, the species, suffers terribly because men are not doing their duty. They're not being men. And the famous phrase today is, man up. I think I know what that means. What it ought to mean is, do what God tells you to do, come hell or high water. No matter what they do to you, have conviction and say, I'd rather do what God says than eat. That's what Jesus Christ said. Well, if we ever get that way, a little bit. If we do it a little bit, God will honor it. Learn what you can. Do what you can. There is no remedy to this lawlessness we're watching except law. And there is no law outside of the only true lawgiver. And that's what the word Elohim means, by the way, in the Old Testament. It means lawgiver. That one from whose judgment of right and wrong there is no appeal in individual instance. That's a lawgiver, a God, we call them. Well, at any rate, that phrase of people is important. Now, work with it. 159 times, you'll find every one of them probably in Strong, but Young would have most of them, I guess. Young is a good concordance. I don't hear it talked about much. It's just not as complete as Strong. Go ahead. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm good. Yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Okay. You bet. Have a blessed night. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Yep.
Okay. Next questioner is John. Go ahead, John.
Hello, Gerard. For some reason, I can hardly hear you now.
Okay. How's that?
Hey, that's much better. Much better. Okay, thank you. I, for quite some time, have had the nagging feeling that I may not adequately comprehend what we are living in. I think the reason for this puzzlement is that it seems to permeate every level of government and every activity that people in this country are taking part in, especially the law-abiding people. I think I'm asking this for all of the members in LA, too, or if anyone does not have these questions, then they must have the answers. So could you make an attempt at that, answering that?
I'm not sure. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Gerard. No, I was going to say what I think you're going to say. I'm not sure I caught the question. Is that what you're going to say, Gerard?
That's what I was going to say. I'm not sure I understand.
Yeah.
When you say what we're living in, you're talking about the system of government, the type of government, or what? I mean,
yes,
look at
Because that has the most impact upon all of us. And the court system and so forth, yes.
Well, you want me to respond, Gerard?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, and I may say something when you're done, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, it is important, in my stated opinion, that, of course, it's important that we understand that fundamentally who we are. And we need to go back and remind ourselves often, as the Bible would put it, go back and shore up the foundations. And the thing that distinguishes us from all the rest of the world, our government, is our government. By the way, God doesn't call men to himself, but for one reason, that's to have a people that will do his government among themselves. That's all he wants. His law is his will. Law, it's his will. And he wants to empower us to do what he wants us to do. And that brings him honor. That's what he wants. Just like I am honored when my children, when I learn that my children are following my point of view. It honors me.
May I
like it. Yeah, go ahead.
May I say something at this point?
Sure.
I don't view my problem or other people's problems as those which are affecting the situation because of our relationship to God. I think I have a pretty good relationship as I perceive that God, you know. So what I seem to perceive is that we have almost unbelievable corruption at every level, and of course I think that the court system is a very primary part of the government, because that's there to ensure justice, and if it doesn't, that adversely affects the whole rest of society.
I agree. If justice isn't done on the individual instance, the individual level and individual instances, there is no justice, because justice doesn't exist for any corporate body, never has, that's impossible. So the courts are the only part of government that try to individual justice in individual instances. And the corruption is, I agree with you, it's out of control.
I'd like to say something at this point, because I kind of think I know where he's going, and okay. I kind of think I know what this problem is that he's referring to. Mm-hmm. And you said it in the first sentence. You said fundamental. You see, mm-hmm. the problem we have in this country is we've gotten away from the fundamental principles that would keep us in those guidelines. You see, when you have knowledge of those fundamental principles, it's power. If you go into court and you can hold on to the fundamental principles, you can argue anything and you'll win, as long as you're in a court of law. But if you're giving credibility to a fiction, which is what they've done, they've overlaid a fiction, and now they want to talk about this and that and all these other things that get far, far afield of where we're supposed to be, and now that lets the corruption leak in, because now we're over there debating what is the meaning of is, and we've gotten away from that fundamental principle, which is really where we should have been in the first place, because we're talking about a violation of somebody and a wrongdoing and the correction thereof. And when you start getting too far away from the fundamental principles, then you lose the fundamental – you lose the blessings of those fundamental principles is what happened. Now, you don't have to say it's a religious thing, but these laws were based on those fundamental principles that came out of the Mosaic Law. Now, whether you agree or not with those that particular law or that particular religion, it's not about that. What we're saying is, look, if you want freedom and you want the blessings of that freedom, you live according to this way. We know it works because we see how it works. Because, you know, look, you don't have to be a Christian or a Catholic or a Lutheran or anything else. The principles that Jesus Christ taught were love thy neighbor, you know, love the law, love God, and love your neighbor. Very simple. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Those are fundamental principles. We don't have to split it down to a denomination. It's a good idea, no? And when you're in America, those are the good ideas that we're founded on. So whether you agree with the aspect of where they came from, you're getting the blessings thereof. And so the guys that put the fiction on top of it and started splitting hairs, they're just like what the scribes and Pharisees did. They were looking to make money. They were looking to see where they could split hairs. They were looking where they could take away what was yours for themselves. And that's what it's about. And that's why we need to stick to that, because that's it always ends up going to those guys that speak with forked tongues, end up walking away with your liberty. So that's my take on where you're going, kind of.
How can we expect justice if we go justice with regard to people on the land, if we go into a court of justice that operates on the court on the law of the sea?
Oh, now therein is the problem, isn't it? You got to know how to do that tap dance. You see, that's because you can't let them get there. You see, people go in and they don't know how to hold themselves on the land. You see? And their contract, they're getting drawn away from that. You know, that's why we talk about a court of record, you know what I mean, where we're coming in under common law, not under admiralty. And if you and they're very good at floating you away, aren't they? But look at the fundamental principles are on the land. We look at our Constitution, like Brent says, it rises out of the land. If you don't know how to keep your feet on the land, then you got no business going in that court trying to defend yourself. Because it's like it says in the Bible, why do you go into their courts looking for justice? When he says their courts, he's talking about those foreign jurisdictions that they've overlaid.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about their Roman civil laws, their Babylonian courts. He's not talking about the fundamental courts that this land was established on. We got away from that. So we're not going in their courts looking. We're going into our courts. We're proclaiming it in the beginning, in the preamble of our lawsuit, of the where we describe the jurisdiction we're going in. And if they want to go off of that jurisdiction, it's game over. We don't talk. Look at that's where you grab the judge and say, "Oh, excuse me, that's not me. Where are you going? Where are you taking me? You know, you're a magistrate. You're not a judge here. The jury is the tribunal. If you don't know how to do those things, then you got no business being there, because you're only going to empower them every time you lose. When you go in with and you try to say that you're on the law of the land, but yet you don't know how to couch it in a way so that they end up making you look like an idiot, you just did a disservice to that law, you know? I mean, I know I'm being a little tough here, but that's really the facts of the matter.
No, you're not being tough. Go ahead. Go ahead.
And, Brett, I don't know if you don't agree with that. You could also, you know, you could correct that if you want. I mean,
oh, no. No, I agree. I just didn't want to get in the way of him. He wanted to say something else. I agree. Let me say this. Now that you give me a little room to talk, I guess. It came to mind we were talking, and we need to be doing this. We're not doing it. Paul the Apostle tells us, he's writing to the Corinthians, he said, you fellas, he just tells them, you must impanel your own juries. You know, if you think you're going to get justice going into these Roman courts, you're kidding yourself. And you choose the least esteemed among you, you impanel them. And you, when it comes to disputes of property and things of this life, short of capital crimes, you guys figure it out yourself. You solve your own problems among yourselves. Don't go to them. And I agree also with the idea, that's what we need to be doing privately. Privately, that means outside of government, we need to be resolving our own problems, and Paul tells us how to do it. And the next to Jesus of that our explanation of that passage tells it all. It's all right there, and then add other things to it to support it. Go ahead. Oh, you want to start? And the other thing you mentioned was fundamentals, obviously. And we are a common law country. That's what distinguishes us. And the fundamentals that we have are the things we're ignoring. Like I was talking a while ago about due process, of all the fundamentals we have. In our Constitution even says this, due process is fundamental. And in a common law country, you go into court, you argue fundamentals. You don't argue minutia. Justice Scalia used to say that. He said, judges, we get more bureaucratic every year, and all we do is interpret statutes and regulations. But if you're thinking right, you go into court, you say, look, I don't want to interpret this statute. This statute's unconstitutional. See, that goes back to fundamentals. Our Constitution has fundamental common law principles in it. And those are the things you should argue instead of trying to, they'll drag you off into trying to argue about minutia of a regulation. And the IRS is good at that. And, of course, somebody needs to be saying, wait a minute, why are we even looking at this stuff? Is this even constitutional that we have an IRS or an income tax? And on we can go. What's fundamental here? What's the bottom line of our common law? How about monopolies? Is there a monopoly here? Yes, there's a monopoly on issuing some money. Edward Koch said, and our founders relied on him more than anybody else, that all monopolies are unlawful because all monopolies are against the law, and all monopolies are against the freedom of the individual, and all no monopoly, he said, can exist without government force. Well, we've got one bank issuing all the money in the country. That's a monopoly. It's lawless. It's unlawful. It's destroying us. Has been for a long time. It's getting worse. We need to argue those kind of fundamentals. What does our common law say at the fundamental point? That's what we should do. Go ahead.
Well, why not make a list of these priorities that you have there? I fully agree with you. So that we can keep them uppermost in our mind and go down the list and check them. And this is something related to it, which I had written down. Many people end up being victims of the judicial system. The corruption is there. And perhaps as a member of NLA and all the, in regard to all the other members there, we could do a service to them by listing these priorities and then going to whatever de facto individual or group that would be most appropriate to answer our questions and get answers of good clarity as to why they proceed as they do, not just because they can get away with it, but from their perspective. So it's an open, what I would like to think would be an open discussion rather than an open debate where you're out to try to beat someone, you know. And that way it would be an ongoing clarification so that we know what we're dealing with.
You mean a clarification of the fundamentals? Is that what you're saying? A clarification
yes.
of the fundamentals? Yeah.
Right. What, you know, there was a comment earlier about the judge saying, do you understand me? And you said, no, that's not really a concern. Well, I would say that it may be a concern, but if you're in doubt, I think we could change that word and why not ask, do you comprehend what I am saying?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
No, go ahead. I'll finish your sentence then.
Okay. And let's see here. This is a universal problem, and this is all I'm going to ask about. I've taken up enough time, but this is universally a problem for all of us at this time, I think, and that is the all caps name. That is nothing but fraud, because I don't think we're ever enlightened as to what the nature of that was until we finally deduced that, hey, there's something basically wrong here. So they found that out. But that's another one of those things to put on a priority list. Not only the nature of the all caps name, but where exactly is it? Who runs it? Who controls it? And since it's in our name, based on our birth documents, we should be able to capture that as our property. And so forth. So that's all I have to say for now. Thank you very much.
Well, a lot of these things that people say drag us into the wrong jurisdiction. I keep saying jurisdiction is another word for right, and no man has a right to do wrong. No man has a right to do wrong. Therefore, no man has jurisdiction to do wrong. Authority is another synonym. Therefore, no man has authority to do wrong. So it is impossible that someone, it's impossible as a matter of law, that anyone could drag you into an unlawful jurisdiction. Because an unlawful jurisdiction is no law at all. There's no right there. It's a facade. It's a lie. It's fraud. And if it's fraud, then it's not jurisdiction. So I try to remind folk, let's don't even talk like they have that power. They don't. The devil doesn't have any, he has power. I should make this distinction. It's an important one. There is power in the evil empire, but there is not right. There is not jurisdiction. There is no bailiwick that's been delegated to them from the source of all authority. Romans chapter 13, God himself, the only lawgiver. All authority, says Paul the apostle, is from God. And there is no jurisdiction. That's a good translation of that word there. There is not power. Jurisdiction, there is no jurisdiction, but it has not come from him. It's all jurisdiction that men hold is derived from the lawgiver himself. I don't have any authority in this life, except it has been delegated to me from above. And we don't have anything we haven't gotten from above, but there is no jurisdiction to do wrong. And therefore, when you talk about, well, they did this, and the courts are trying to pull this fraud or that fraud, that's just power. That's not right. That's not jurisdiction. I don't think it's a thing to acknowledge what is wrong and to adorn it with words like jurisdiction. I think we, again, do ourselves a disservice. The devil is clever in the extreme, more than any of us could ever imagine, and to learn his wiles of the useful idiots that he uses. To learn them, words are a big part of that, and of course, go back to fundamentals, go back to that parcel of real estate called the Garden of Eden, and what old Scratch did there. It was all about the twisting of words. He is a mealy-mouthed, syrupy. He's got the pride of a nanny goat. None at all. He'll do anything. And his minions, by the way, have no pride either. Watch him step and fetch. I was watching some, I don't remember his name, he's a left-wing commenter on the television. I've seen him, I can picture him, but I saw him talking to somebody somewhere on YouTube or something not long ago, and he was utterly panicked. And he was saying things like, well, I did say this, I did say that about Donald Trump, but Donald Trump has power now, so we'll just have to wait and see. And he was nervous and panicked. These people live in fear all the time, and if they aren't in power, they have no conviction, they'll just fall down like an old whore and give them whatever they want. That's the way he was acting. He was just acting like he was nothing but up for sale, and he would do whatever he had to do to preserve himself. That's not manliness. And the folks on the other side are living like that every day of their lives. And the ones that are following the evil empire, I don't care what position they're in, how high it is, they may look like they're somebody, but if you got close to them, you'd say, and this is the person that's ruling the country? It would shock you, probably. Probably couldn't stand to get close to them for the smell. I've even heard that about some of them. Don't know how to take a bath. Well, at any rate, I'm not naming names, and I don't know if that's true. I just know I've been around people that were in high positions of power. When you're around them, you find out that they're lower than anybody you know in your local community on a personal level. Well, that's all I have to say about that. I'll end to say this, though, Gerard, real quick. Our fundamentals are common law. Oh, and also, and asking this question and going back to fundamentals, that drives me back to, and I've started a presentation series on the radio concerning our common law. And it's an unknown number of parts, this series of presentations. But I said I just need to be talking about it. It's the mystery that people, our fundamentals, who are we? What distinguishes us? And we had a fellow come on here recently and talk about, on the radio station where I'm on, another lawyer, talking about courts do not make law. Courts do not make law. Well, that's true. Courts aren't lawmakers, but neither are legislators lawmakers either, not in our common law tradition. We call them that, but they aren't. We say our courts find law and they give opinions. They don't say that in Germany and France and Italy. They make law there. Men make law. The code is the law. That's not true in our common law country. But then he said, our case law system is flawed. That's the way he puts it. He wrote a little song about it. And what he's saying there is, and I don't go along with this exactly, now, our common law system is about following the guidance of courts. And there's no law in the books that says that courts have to follow the guidance of courts. It's part of our common law tradition. It's unwritten. We do it. We call it precedent. Stare decisis. Let the decision stand. If we didn't do that, and it seems like that's what he's complaining about, if we didn't do that, we'd be in bondage to whatever the Congress or the state legislature said. I'm not willing to go there. And early on in our country, we did that. We said we want popular sovereignty. We thought that was the answer. It's popularly called republicanism. Well, states like Pennsylvania found out within just a few short years they didn't want that at all. They gave all power to the popular assembly. And other states tried it too after our separation from Britain. It didn't work. The tyranny of a legislature is bad or worse than the tyranny of one man. At least you can get a hold of one man. When it comes down to a legislature, you can't really identify who the problem is. And then it becomes a vicious, like it is now with Congress, just a vicious competition to who you can keep in office to get more money to come back to your district. That's all it's been about forever. And that's tyranny. But if there aren't courts that are wholly and utterly independent, again, I don't care how crazy they get, you've got to have that with juries. The power has to be divided in government. The courts can't trump the other two branches, and neither one of the other two branches can trump the others. It's co-equal in every state and in our federal government. Those are common law fundamentals. Those are not ideas of our founders. Those were the things that the Anglo-Danes had come to before Magna Carta, before the English Revolution. And the English Revolution and the American Revolution were an attempt, the Magna Carta itself were an attempt to reach back and recapture those fundamentals of old Anglo-Saxon government during the watch, I should say, of King Alfred the Great and before. That's what our founders said they wanted to do. And it's important to go back and talk about those fundamentals and shore up the things that make us different. What makes us different from the rest of the world? Trial by jury. They don't do that anywhere else. They claim they do, but they don't when you look at it close. Grand jury, separation of three branches of government, due process as we understand it, the right to remain silent, the right to free speech, the right to not speak. Another common law tradition, our judges come from the private practice of law. They do not come from government employment. Well, they shouldn't, but they do now. That's where they come from, most of them. You know, it's just a thing, it's a track anymore in most of the local communities. You get elected or you get appointed to prosecutor, then you become state's attorney, then you run for judge. Well, by the time you get on the bench, again, like Justice Scalia said, I'm quoting Justice Scalia. He said, take a man that's had his nose in the trough like a hog his entire life. Is he going to be loyal to someone other than the fellow that fills the trough? He was speaking of government employees, and Justice Scalia was a government employee. He understood. And it is true that if you eat the king's bread, you're going to be loyal to the king. I'm loyal to people. I'm loyal to clients that if they come and pay me to do something, I'm loyal to them. It's natural. It's not unnatural. Can't say there's anything wrong with it. It's just that we try to keep it in its place. And our common law tradition has taught us how to do that. But who even knows that that's part of our common law tradition? It is. And many other things, many small things. Another one. That appellate judges give opinions, and they must have dissenting opinions. We require that in America of our appellate judges. If they disagree, we require them to say so, and then give us with that their understanding. That those reasons that stand under their opinions, well, that's not even allowed in the rest of the world. Only in the English-speaking world do we do that. Those are common law fundamentals without which we would not have freedom. It would go away quick. But we don't stop to think about it. Nobody even tells us about it. Lawyers don't even know about it. It's not taught in law schools. And if they are the guardians, if lawyers, and they have been traditionally in the English-speaking world, the lawyers have been the guardians of those fundamental, the understanding of those fundamental freedoms. Anybody else can be too, don't get me wrong, but lawyers, because of their position, they be hired, they go to battle by trial. Men used to hire somebody to do trial by battle. They'd hire a champion. People get a lawyer. He knows the weapons a little better, cross-examination, due process, procedure, whatever. But all those fundamentals are being ignored. But I am on the radio. You go to commonlawyer.com. I'm on the radio. You go to commonlawyer.com and see there when I'm on the radio. People say I ramble too much sometimes when I talk, but if you can get anything out of the rambling, sift it out. And if that's what is important to you, I hope it is, I'd suggest you try it. Thanks, Gerard. That's enough for that.
Thank you, Brent. I think we should go back to trial by battle. It would probably get rid of a lot of problems.
Oh, yeah. The trouble with trial by battle, and they changed the law in England, and it kind of, because the guys that had money could hire a better champion, and it wasn't fair.
It's like baseball, right?
Yeah, you're right. Then the poor guy,
Steinbrenner, hiring all the best players in the world. Okay.
The poor guy that can't hire a lawyer was the poor guy back then that couldn't hire a champion. So now when we got to America with the invention of the firearm, that kind of evens things out a little bit.
The great equalizer, right? Yeah.
So it worked here for a while, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Tim, I know you've been waiting a long time. Go ahead, buddy.
Okay, thanks, gentlemen, for taking my call. This is Tim from Michigan. I have a two-part question, but I'll ask the first part and wait for Mr. Winter's answer. Since every man is automatically a militia member first, does that prevent his being drafted into involuntary federal military duty?
Well, that's a question our country has never totally resolved. They've resolved it by force, obviously, and every time conscription, it's called, or draft, every time it comes up during war, then the fights begin again. And I'm with you, and the only man to ever run for president of the United States from a federal prison took the same position. His name was Eugene Debs, and Woodrow Wilson saw to it that he received the result he wanted, and he was thrown in prison for telling people that to submit to the draft during World War I was involuntary servitude. He got 10 years in federal prison down in Georgia out of it. And then, of course, most of us remember back in the 60s all the shenanigans that went on with the draft. But the draft is not the militia. And therefore, it seems to me, I've come to this conclusion over the years, it is involuntary servitude. It is unlawful. I don't see that our Constitution directly allows it. But clearly, the federal government has the powers our Constitution gives it, and that's it. And it's a government, the general government in D.C., is a government of limited power. But once the draft starts, now they're talking about requiring the female of our species to register for the draft. Once that the government has that force, they want to pound everybody into that mold, including our most precious members. And that's not proper either. So I'm kind of like you. You are a member of the militia. Anybody who's able-bodied to carry a weapon in battle or serve on jury or both. And you're a member of the militia because God says so. That's the way I understand it, and that's my studied opinion. I don't think it's a matter of opinion. If you believe the laws of nature, and the laws of nature, God, by the way, Those two volumes, The Laws of Nature and The Laws of Nature's God, are our fundamental law. People say, well, Gerard said it a while ago, that our laws arise out of the Mosaic law. Well, that's true. But it's not like that's an option for us. Our organic law, the Declaration of 76 being one of those, declared to be so, and it is. In that document, it cites the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. And the laws of nature is a phrase we find in William Blackstone's commentaries on the common law. We find it in with John Locke, and both of those men received that particular set of phrases from the Scottish Enlightenment. The Scottish Enlightenment arose out of the Reformation of the Christian Church in Scotland. The leader there was most famous with John Knox. Established the utter authority of the Bible. The utter authority of the Bible as final law. And those fellows were no slouches. They plumbed the depths of the law of God. What God wants for men and what he requires. They sorted it all out. Maybe there's something else could be said or done. I don't know. Go back and read the writings. You realize these fellows knew what they were doing, and they had the tools to plumb the depths of it. And that phrase, laws of nature and laws of nature, got a root, arose out of first establishing the laws of nature's God. The laws of nature's God refers to that written volume called the Bible. Blackstone acknowledges that. John Locke acknowledges that. Tom Jefferson took the phrase from men like Locke. Locke was an addict of the Scottish Enlightenment. He himself was not Scottish, but he was British like them. And the Scottish Enlightenment took over the whole island and all the people in it. And John Locke was one of them. John Locke, a man of Puritan sensibilities. His father was a Puritan. He was educated by the most famous of Puritans in Britain, John Owen. And John Locke himself was a Bible believer, wrote a commentary on the Bible. I don't know why it's ignored. But he recognized the laws of nature's God. But then the Scottish Enlightenment went further and said, well, God reveals himself in that first volume called the Bible. Does he reveal himself in his creation? And the answer is yes. And I like to put it this way. God reveals himself unwritten in the nature of things. He certainly does. And all the laws of nature, all the laws that govern our lives moment by moment every day that we must pay attention to or we'll suffer terrible bodily injury or die or go broke or starve to death. You've got to feed your body. If you don't feed your body, that's a law of nature. You're going to die. You've got to sleep. You can't drink too much. You'll die of alcohol poisoning. You can't eat too much. You'll be miserable. And on and on and on. They're just the laws of nature all around us. We can't ignore them. And the Scottish Enlightenment said, well, absolutely. We must learn the laws of nature. It's no accident that the Scottish people, after that, and a lot of them came to America, invented a lot of things. And all the inventions that occurred in America came out of that mindset of the Scottish Enlightenment that took over the English-speaking world. And it was they were the ones that said there are two volumes of law, the laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things, meant to be observed and followed, and the laws of nature of God written in the Bible. And the final rule, in cases of question between those two volumes, is the laws of nature's God. The laws of nature includes our common law, due process. And our common law has always said, the judges have always said, that anything said to be a part of our common law that's inconsonant with the Bible is not part of our common law. Any declaration made, any observation made that is found to be contrary to the Bible is false and should be discarded. So that's our fundamental law as Americans. And when things get as crazy as they are now, when pedophiles have taken over our land, they are defiling it. When all these crazy things are happening, I say it's smart to go back and look at the foundations and shore them up and say, now, wait a minute. What is our fundamental law? Because anything that man says that violates it, ultimately, the law of God expressly written, frozen, as clear and beautiful as a beautiful fossil. It's there. It's not mush. Those languages aren't spoken anymore. The Greek, Chaldean, the Hebrew, they're, the people say, they're dead language. No, they're frozen. I like to say they're frozen in place. They don't change now because we don't speak them anymore. No, the Hebrew, they talk over there in the state of Israel, is not the Hebrew of the Bible. by a long shot. It's changed a lot. At any rate, that's kind of what
I think
is important.
Hey, Brent, I want to add a little more to what you said about, you know, the, if it's not in the Constitution, it's not there. As far as the draft goes, look,
yeah,
I don't know if you guys remember back in the 60s with all the craziness, they tried to draft Muhammad Ali and he refused and he would not back down and they put him in jail. He served some jail time and he ended up, you know, there was a lot of racial stuff going on and of course he played that card. But he ended up winning, and they let him go, and they dropped the charges eventually. And I love him or hate him, you know, he was up against a lot of stuff, and he refused to back down. But look, if we had an enemy that was attacking us, first of all, the president has the power to call the militia out to defend the country. Now, mm-hmm. if it required going overseas to some, in order to finish that war, you know what I mean, or for whatever strategic reason, I dare say they would never need a draft. If they attacked us and we had to go over there, they would have more guys volunteering to go over there. They wouldn't need a freaking draft, okay? So
that's right.
I'm sorry. Yeah, so it's just a control thing, I think. You know what I mean? So
I do.
That's my two cents on that. So I think he's right. I think you need to stick to those fundamental principles. And if we did that, those problems would go away. But
I agree.
You got another, yeah.
I agree. Is there another questioner on the line, Gerard?
We got lots of questioners. There was nobody there, but they're coming in. And Tim said he had a two-part question, and that was only one. And
I'll tell you what, I'm saying this to try to discipline myself. I'm going to try to be quicker with the answers, not talk so much. Maybe we can get the rest of these in. We haven't got a lot of time.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Tim, go ahead. What was the other question you had?
Thank you, gentlemen. Part B is, is voluntary federal military service allowable to militiamen?
I never thought of it. I'd never. Yeah.
Are you a lawyer?
No. Yeah.
No, not yet.
No, not yet. Good answer.
Yeah, I'd never thought of that. I would assume it is. If a guy
wants
to
volunteer, it's
probably allowable
unless you're called up. You probably can do it as long as you haven't been called up. How's that?
Yeah. Or I wondered if maybe the militiaman would need to be released by his commanding officer in the militia.
Oh, I see what you're saying. And that's a problem I haven't wrapped my mind around. And that's an important question. And those are the things the courts would sort out. And that's why we have common law courts, so they can interpret the things that the legislators would obviously hadn't thought of. You know, legislation is always an attempt to control the future. And in a civil law country, they try to make the legislation as detailed as possible so the courts don't have anything to do except enforce whatever. And everybody fits into the category. And that's foolishness because legislators aren't God. But, yeah.
Think about it. If the president called the militia up because we were under an attack, and so you're activated now, and now they want you to go overseas, it's a common sense thing that you would have to be released because you're under that command. In other words, they got first dibs on you. You've been activated, right? And if you wanted to volunteer to go overseas, I think it's a no-brainer that you couldn't go unless your commander released, because you're already in the process of doing whatever he's telling you to do. They couldn't expect you to leave. It wouldn't make sense. And maybe they're not here now. Maybe you're just sitting there idle waiting for the next wave or whatever. But I think that was a good question, and I think it's a no-brainer that they would have to release you in order for you to volunteer to go over there. Makes sense to me. You're already engaged in a job.
I was going to say, the president, if he called the militia up first, the governor wouldn't have any power over his state's militia if the president called them up first. Now, if the governor called them up first, then he would have power over them. That's always been the law in America. But if the president calls them up, then they become a part of the armed forces of the United States. But that's not exactly the question he's asking, but that's one of the things that would happen. It would depend upon who would call them up first. That would have something to do with it.
That throws another wrinkle in it now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably does.
Oh, anyway, let's hope we never have to go there, first of all. Anyway, does that satisfy you there, Tim? Okay.
Yep, that squares me, and God bless everybody on the call tonight.
Thanks. You, Tim. Okay, next question. I don't know who it is. It looks like Ben's in 1652. Give us a first name and a state, would you please? You've been unmuted. Hello, hello. 1652. We've got much time. I'll go to the next person here in a second here. We got Philip hanging in the breeze. Okay, I'm going to go to the next guy. I guess you we put you to sleep with our talk here. The next guy. Okay, Philip, you've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Great. I'm new. This is the first a hearing I'm having with you guys. So I've gone through all the classes and the constitutional teachings, and I took the course, or I listened to the videos on the traffic court. And I was looking for and trying to find, they made reference to the five motions that you have to file before if you don't get your court case dismissed. I was wondering if somebody could tell me where those are.
Well, that's a good question, because, you know, we found that I don't know how you found that video. That was one of the first videos we put up that we ran across, and it's very interesting, that whole line of questioning. And then I think if I remember right, they say for the motions hearing that you're going to go to and make him answer each motion, you know, separately, and try not to get them to rule on all of them together. So
exactly.
Look, I never did find out what those motions were, but, you know, going back to the fundamental principles, you can imagine what they would be. I mean, they're challenging the jurisdiction, and they're challenging what he's doing. So any motions that you're going to give would be the motions that would have him define where he thinks that he has control, or how his court has control over you, right? So, you know, you have to ask them in such a way that he would have to answer that. Now, I don't know where that came out of. I know that there's we used to belong to this site called Your Remedies in the Law, and they got different people that come on and teach you how to do certain types of law, and there's one guy on there that does nothing but traffic court, and he has like an 89 or 90% success rate in traffic court. And I don't know if it relates to that or not, but I know that he goes through that whole right to travel thing. So I don't know what to tell you there. I never did really pursue it, because we were trying to get into the courts with the common law grand jury. We're trying to get the court of record established, which is our right to a jury, and the judge being the magistrate in his proper place, where the jury is actually ruling on the law and not the opinion of some judge's opinion, not based on anything. So I wish I could help you with that, and I don't know. And maybe one day, if I get some time, I'll sit down and I don't know how successful that was, but I'll tell you what, that first part of that tape was pretty good, I thought.
I thought it was excellent, both parts. the first
yeah.
one.
The first and second, but then they talk about you're going to have you're going to ask for a motions hearing. You know, we do have a traffic court type course, and you know the main thing with that tape is it gets you out of court without really pleading, and the other one that was pretty good that I thought was. I think it's Carl Lentz, Get Out of Jail Free, if you Google him or on YouTube, search him, and he's got the Get Out of Jail Free card. Now, what he does is he tells you how to get out of there without actually pleading, and then doing the rest of your work in paperwork, see, so that you're not sitting in front of the judge sticking your foot in your mouth, getting held in contempt. And what happens is you put the – you know, they don't want to answer that paperwork. They can't, because they can't. You know, because the questions you're asking them, they have no jurisdiction over what they're trying to do to you. So what happens is you move from stage to stage with that process, and usually by the time you get down, you know, and you follow his methodology, and usually they'll throw the ticket out because they can't stand it. They're not going to spend. Look, their whole thing is to make money. And
yep.
You going in there and stymieing them and stalling them and making them answer questions and demanding jury trials and, you know, asserting your rights, it bothers them. And they have to answer. And you know, the prosecutor has to answer. Really, there should be a prosecutor too, right? So on a stupid ticket that they're looking to make $100 or $200, and you're coming and you got 5, 6, 7 papers filed, they're already losing money. A lot of times they just throw it out, and that's really a victory in itself when they throw it out. If everybody did it, that court would go away. If everybody just said, I'm not guilty and I want a trial, and I'm not talking necessarily about a jury trial because they don't want to give you a jury trial, even though the Constitution says if it's over $20, which is always $20 because the state surcharge is always over that. So it goes automatically that you should have a jury trial, but they're not going to give you a jury trial on a traffic ticket. And if you just said, if everybody went in and said, I'm not guilty and I want a trial, where you come back the next month and you stand in front of the judge with the cop there and the two of you argue a losing battle because you're going to fine for the cop. But if everybody did that, they don't have enough resources to do even that. They write that many tickets that they couldn't schedule enough trials. The money would grind to a halt and they'd be done. So that's my take on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree. I got one other problem is I am being sued by it's the Utah State Bar.
Boy, what did
they're
you do
suing
to deserve
me
that?
For the unauthorized practice of law. And
really?
I didn't practice, at least I didn't think I had practiced any law. I had set up a nonprofit corporation under the name Hanley Law Group Nonprofit to help people. So I was trying to do stuff online to help save people's homes or bargain down their loans with the bank.
Let me tell you what, you went in the wrong direction because they're vicious with that stuff. The fact that you set up a nonprofit, did it really put you in a bad spot? I'll be honest with you. In my mind, because you kind of entered into their fiction with it. And then you said you're not practicing law, but yet you're helping people in the court, and you have a fiction of the state. You know, you're collecting money to do it?
I am.
Yeah, well, then,
but
as far as they're
little.
Concerned, they don't care. I think a dime makes the crime. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's like you collected money, you got a non-for-profit, and you're calling yourself such and such law. You're going to have a hard time beating that one with them. You know, I don't know what to tell you on that. I mean, not that we give, you know, I can't really give you legal advice on here. I wouldn't want to, because the next thing you know, they'll be coming after me. But, you know, I would never, I call myself assistance of counsel, you know what I mean, that type of thing. And look, I wouldn't take any money for doing it. I mean, you can look at, I wouldn't advertise that I'm taking any money. Somebody wanted to pay my expenses to get to court or something. You know what I'm saying? The minute you're exchanging money for something, it's a business. And if it's a business that they think that they regulate, which they absolutely do, you're in their territory, boy. You jumped right into their, come into my parlor, said the spider to the fly. You went right in. So I don't know what to tell you on that one. That one's going to be tough. I would try to get the heck out of there as quick as I could, however I could, even if it was beg for mercy. You know what I mean?
Do you live in Utah?
No, I moved to Wisconsin. I live in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Are they? Is it a criminal? Is it a criminal matter or a civil or a non-criminal?
Oh no, it's a civil case.
Oh, that's good. Have they served you yet?
Well, they've tried to. I returned it to them. I said, I'm not that person you're serving. I'm rejecting it, and did it within 3 days and sent it back, returned receipt requested.
Well, they've got to get personal jurisdiction over you. They got to serve you personally, don't they?
They think they did.
I would say this, though, if you're in another state, whatever you do, don't communicate with them. Don't say anything to them. Don't say, I'm coming or I'm not coming, or tell your court you don't have jurisdiction over me. If you say anything to them, they'll use that against you and say they've got jurisdiction because you're communicating.
Right.
That's why we have separate states. And if you're real persnickety about observing, just acting like they don't have any power over you, then it might help a little. It's interesting. I'd be curious to see how it comes out, what they try to do.
Well, I'm trying to throw everything I can think of at them, but I tried to file electronically, and they won't let me do that. They want me to send everything, register mail to the clerk of the court, and I said, wait a minute. Your own rules are saying I can file electronically or on fax and or email. And it's right in their rules. And the judge can't do that.
You ticked them off. You ticked them off really good.
Yeah.
But like Brent says, look, you're in a different state. Let them prove jurisdiction. And like he says, the less contact you have, the harder it's going to be for them. They're not going to come and extradite you for it. I mean, how much are they suing you for? I mean, is it?
I don't know.
Okay.
They don't disclose that. They're saying they're looking for some orders against me to don't do anything on the internet, that I can't do.
They're going to get the judge to do right. They're going to get the judge to restrict you and order you to never do this or that again, and slap your hand and send you home.
Wow.
What's your tail between your legs?
What I don't like is that I've got the right to work any way I want. And listening to them, it sounds like I don't.
Well, yeah.
I think they are stepping on my toes, not me stepping on
toes. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting.
Well, I raised a whole bunch of constitutional issues that they won't even address. The
like
judge won't even address jurisdiction.
Yeah.
He won't even address my motions. He won't address any of my... I've sent 10 notices to him. He won't address them. They even refused to record them until I started sending them return receipt certified. And then I tried to sue. The Bar Association is a corporation in Utah. It is not anything else. And
well, they all are. I think they all are.
They're all corporations?
Oh, yeah.
Well, here's my question. If it's a corporation that has no members, and I said, well, you're suing me, you're saying I've had some form of a contract with you then, what did I violate?
They can't answer that.
Who's the injured party? What are the possible damages? They won't answer those.
Well, they won't because they can't. But that won't stop them from trying to make your life miserable.
Is your website still up?
Oh, of course.
What's the name of it?
Hanley Law Group.
Hanley, H-A-N-L-E-Y?
Yeah, H-A-N-L-E-Y, lawgroup.com, and .net, and .org.
That's why they're still coming after you. Look, they want that website down. As long as it's up, it's flying in their faces, so to speak. So, but they don't dare go in and take it down without having a hearing. You see,
they can't take it down.
Well, you know, they can't. What they can and can't do, you know, just like you said, they won't do this, they won't do that. You know, if they can, they'll turn around and figure out how you're some kind of terrorist. They'll have Homeland Security go in there and take it down. Don't ever underestimate where they won't go, these people. You know what I mean?
Well,
so, I just, you know, I don't know where they'll go or where they won't go. But, you know, the fact that it's up and they want it down, and I think that they're afraid to actually try to turn it off without having some kind of a something over you, that where they have control over you, where they have charges on you, where they can arrest you. You see, so you're still kind of like on the peripheral, on the edges, but that website is a burr under their saddles. I'm just telling, you know what I'm saying? The reason they're still bothering you is because it's up there, and they don't want it up, you know, you're cutting into their territory. So
well,
I mean, look, it's a matter of principle with you, I can tell. You got to pick your battles. I mean, I guess you can take it all the way to the mat. I don't know what to tell you on it as far as, you know, look, you're in another, there's a whole bunch of different things here overlaid, like you're in a different state. Like Brent says, you're talking to them. They're going to say, well, we have this jurisdiction, that jurisdiction. I don't know, but it's a slippery slope, I think you're on, as far as, you know, where they can go or where they will go. And I in my mind, the fact that the website's up, that's the problem as far as they're concerned. You haven't really gone away. You're still out there. You're in their face. You're in a different state. And as soon as they figure out, look at you tick them off enough, they'll go out and make some legislation just for you, special just for you. So just be careful.
Did you ever live in Utah?
Oh, I did. I lived out there for 5-6 years.
And you had this going. Is that why did they come after you when you were out there? But then you moved since they...
Oh, no. No, they didn't come after me until after I moved.
That's a problem. That's a problem. And it's the Utah State Bar Association. So they're going to have trouble proving jurisdiction, don't you think, Brent?
Oh, yeah, that's what, but sound like he's been contacted or he's been in communication with them. They'll take that as jurisdiction probably, right?
Yeah, but yeah. I've asked him, I said, well, okay, fine. You're suing me for what damages and who's the injured party? How can you get damages? How can you have a complaint? And why doesn't the judge, according to the rules, dismiss it? Should have been a summary dismissal immediately. Because they have no cause of action.
Well, see, here's the... And that demonstrates the craziness of legislation. The legislation in that state probably says that if you practice law without a license, and here's what the... And then they define it, and they say you're liable for this much fine if we find you guilty, blah, blah, blah. But damages aren't... See, when you make an offense against the government, damages aren't necessary. It's only when you're in a dispute with a private party at common law that damages become important, and you got to say somebody was injured, but that's not always true either, but it ought to be. I mean, I agree with people to say that, but when it comes to the government, when the legislature makes a command, and it's a command, that's what legislation is, it commands you either do or forbear from doing, damages don't have to be proven. That's the danger of legislation. It's the danger of the whole civil law idea, because the civil law idea tries to control the future behavior of people through government command, whereas our common law waits till there's a problem, and then it goes in front of the jury and asks them what happened in the past. It doesn't talk about the future. That's a big difference. There's another fundamental of our common law that we're not paying attention to. There's a difference between trying to play the prophet and control the future. God says, I control the future. You trust me for the future. You don't go legislating and trying to control people's lives and manipulate people, manipulation and control. That's a psychology. That's all part of the evil empire. Our forebears, our first fathers came here, and they wouldn't have legislation. They said, we've got legislation. God gave it to us right here in the Bible. And all we need to do is establish courts and impanel juries to apply it. And that's what they did. And it worked very well for them. But legislation confuses things, and here's another good example in your situation. Because legislation is... Go ahead, Gerard.
I don't want to get too lost with him. We got one more he's been in 3 times. You can bring that up next week again at the same time, same place. We're kind of interested how you make out. I mean, you obviously got a very interesting situation there, and you know, maybe we can talk, you know, elsewhere. But
yeah,
I'm going to go ahead.
I'm
sorry. I see my finger went crazy, and I didn't let him finish. That wasn't nice. Anyway, 16:52. We're really over time, but go ahead. What's your question? Hello. I knocked him off early for nothing. Look at that. But we're not early.
Too.
Oh, he did. Okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know. And I guess they're not paying attention, but we're already like 3 minutes over. Not that that's a earth-shattering thing, but I'm going to go ahead and say goodnight. Brent, I think it was a really good call. I enjoyed myself. Thank you for all your input. As always, we enjoy
it. My pleasure, and I enjoyed all the comments and questions, too.
Yeah. So thank you, everybody, for coming, and we'll look for you next time. Have a good night, everybody.
Good night.